This episode of Shockwaves is sponsored by Universal Studios' Halloween Horror Nights in Hollywood. Immerse yourself in a living, breathing, three-dimensional world of terror. Now through Saturday, November 5th. Visit them online at halloweenhorrornights.com/Hollywood to learn more about the event and buy tickets.
Okay, and welcome to episode number 20 of Shockwaves. Holy smokes.
20 episodes.
20. That's and not only awesome. That, we did 140 of Killer POV, which, by the way, we just received our Rondo Award for.
They're sitting on the desk there. We've got Rondo's little visage staring
so
at
this
us.
This is going to be
this
our...
This wasn't for the Bloodcast, right?
No. No. Okay, they didn't win anything.
Well, they didn't win anything.
Off to a good start. Ryan, you can kick him under the table.
Neither did the Movie Crypt.
Wait, this wasn't for POV. Adam Green or Joe?
Nope. We won it.
We won
did.
This?
On Ordered. Our own.
Podcast
Thanks
war.
To you guys.
Thanks, Leanne Spider Baby.
So
hang on a second. Elric, give me yours.
No.
Yours? No. Wait. It says Elric Klein.
Almost got you.
Almost the same.
But so this is literally, I mean, thank you if you've been listening to Shockwaves, but if you are new to the show, we were Killer POV, and this is technically our 160th episode together, if you want to put it down like that.
God, I've been staring at you people a long time.
Very long time.
And Ryan was in at least four of those anyway.
That's right.
He appeared a number of times, but also there's
some
really
good
content.
I came out three times, so three awards.
Three awards,
that's right.
But there's some really good content back there. I mean, in terms of interviews, there's some really cool stuff.
Yeah, somebody was tweeting this week about how they just discovered our Charlie Band episode and thought it was so good. That was awesome.
Oh, man. We did, you know what? We did a video, and the one person I completely forgot to thank, which I will thank you now in our episode, is Patrick Bromley over at F This Movie.
Yeah.
Because he did a couple of lists kind of showcasing our best episodes, and a lot of people came to us through that. So thank you, Patrick. But anyway, in case you're wondering who the hell we are, I'm Rob Galuzzo from Blumhouse.com.
Boy.
That's going to be very relevant shortly. Sitting with me is Elric Kane.
Deep in the horror end of whatever.
You know what you forgot to do?
Deep in the annals.
That does not sound better than sex to me.
We planned it, but you already screwed up. We listened to the Shockwaves soundtrack the other day, and it says the deep end of horror in German.
Oh, that's right.
You were supposed to memorize.
Okay, by next week, I'm going to have it in German.
He's going to memorize. He's going to say, like, I love ducks, and that's going to be
it. Ich bin ein Rathaus.
So
really, it felt really weird playing that at a really high volume while I was making dinner, and I had my windows open because I live in an apartment in which my neighbors can hear everything next door, every like little conversation. Mm-hmm. So when it starts lurching into the Nazi chanting, I'm like, I'm going to turn this down.
Oh, your neighbors think you're weird anyway. Come on.
This is true.
So our weird neighbor is Ryan Turek, if you didn't guess already.
Hello.
And Rebecca McKenna, the editor-in-chief of our websites. So welcome to episode 20. We've got a lot to talk about.
Yep. Including last week being kind of controversial. It seemed like it was a polarizing episode. Some people said they love it. Some people are like, what the hell is this?
Oh, really?
I was really...
Well, I think because the subject matter is so crazy.
Well, I mean, you know what? That's what I like. Everyone, even if they didn't like the idea of doing one of these kind of things, tension experience, whatever, then they said I was frustrated because I was tense listening to
it. Yeah, it's intriguing.
Yeah.
Which
I thought was
exciting. And as much as people were trying to turn the Ryan Nipple incident into a thing, there was a dude on Twitter that's like, you know, man, you gotta be comfortable with your manhood to
that's
admit
right.
to something like that.
Yeah.
I was like, all right.
But the fact that he's doing it to us right now is weird. There comes a time.
Ryan, get off the floor, man. Come on.
Well, doing it to Rebecca would just be like completely inappropriate. Hey,
that's so wrong. We're in an office.
That's a mom, dude.
That's a mom.
I'm all in on this, guys. Do it.
That makes a difference.
It's got weird, guys.
Sorry, Becca.
As a mom,
you're off limits.
I don't think about those things anymore.
Well, all right. So enough.
Neither does your husband.
Oh, Jesus.
Thanks, guys. Okay. So anyway, Beyond Fest, Universal, we all did a lot this week that didn't involve nipples,
wow,
right?
That's a lot of changing topics.
Halloween.
Halloween.
We're well into October. Happy October.
Yeah. Well into it. Well into the thick of it. And obviously, you probably noticed the last few episodes have had ads for Universal Horror Nights, which takes place both here in Hollywood and in Florida. Although there's also a Singapore location. I'd like to. I want to know what the Horror Nights is like over there. But
I think next year they need to send us there because I want to cover the Universal Horror Nights Singapore.
Yeah.
Happy ending Horror Nights. Sounds great. That's a ring to a happy ending.
What?
getting wild, guys. Getting wild. Okay, so so we all got to go together, which is a rarity that all three of us.
Yeah.
All of us.
Ryan.
The award winners went together.
whereas development execs went to the opening night.
Oh, that's right.
That's right. Yeah, you're more special. We get it.
No, oh, my God.
You get to roll with James Wan into the maze. Like, it's so cool. But anyway, we all got to go. So we've all been there now. And at least for us, you know, I want to say a thank you to John Murdy, who is the he's the what's his title technically?
He's creative director.
Creative director. Yeah, creative he's a creative director and really the guy behind those mazes.
And as I was witness to, and I'm sure you guys were too, rock star of Halloween Horror Nights.
Which is weird. Yeah. We had people, he was like, he took us through a couple of the mazes and there were people coming up to him asking to take pictures.
And getting his autograph.
Pulling him aside,
like literally, he was guiding us away from the mummy experience and taking us over to, I forgot what maze it was, downstairs. But people were like, yo, Murdy, great job. And then they had the girls coming up and going, oh, can I just want to get a photo with you. And there he is with his like gothic swagger and his cane and his hat. And, you know, and I'm like, damn, dude.
Rock star in that circle. We were surprised that you know, it was really cool. But
we think one person may have recognized us, or they really liked Dave's T-shirt. We're not sure yet.
We're pretty sure it was Dave's T-shirt, not
it
us.
It may have been Dave's T-shirt, but somebody pointed it
out. Goes up to Elric, are you Rob G?
but he was kind enough to walk us through the first couple of mazes we did, which was Halloween 2 and Exorcist. And that was fun because you kind of see the glee in his eye. Like, he'd stop us and be like, no, wait 30
he
seconds.
Would make us hold.
He wanted to make sure we hit all the rooms at the right point and stuff. We're going to have him on the show. I believe it's next week. So that's going to be a fun chat. But in terms of going to the Universal Horror Nights, it's one of the, you know, we were talking last week a little bit about this. There's varying degrees of the sort of events you can do for Halloween, you know, mazes, haunts, experiences that are interactive. To me, Universal is usually at the top of the list because it's studio quality.
Well, it's IPs.
Yeah, it's they are licensing these movies that we grew up loving and getting to really play in those worlds and give us a taste of that. That's not to take away from anything that any other ones do because, you know, for example, I like Knott's because they primarily are very homegrown and do their own version of these different kind of horror legends and stuff. But that's what's impressive, and that's usually why I try my best to make it to Universal every year because I know I'm going to see something top quality.
Yeah.
And I do have to say that I have always – and I mean Universal's great, but I've always been a fan of kind of the professional haunts, the people that all they do all year long is set up haunted houses. And we touched on a few of them last show, but places like Erebus, Netherworld, Bates Motel, these places that it's all they do all year is prep for this. Those are the most amazing haunts I have ever been to. Just if you have one of those near you, I can't recommend enough checking them out. The people who create those are just passionate about them.
Well, right. it was interesting too to see how they freshen up the IPs that they've played with before. Mm-hmm. You know, Walking Dead is now a permanent fixture there, so you don't have to worry about, oh my God, I gotta say, I mean, like, granted, you have to stand in line, front of the line pass being a mandatory thing before you experience
That's what we reckon. You gotta buy front of line pass.
I mean, there's still probably gonna be a wait, but it's gonna
be
moving.
We walked right in.
A 1 minute or 2 minutes was the longest.
Oh, yeah, we waited.
It's a Thursday, so it's a little quieter.
We waited longer for the Simpsons ride than we did for any of the haunts.
Yeah, that's true.
Which is an amazing way to experience.
But it was interesting to see, you know, I mean, like, for Halloween, it was like, well, how do we freshen up the Halloween maze? Well, we do part two. We do Halloween 2 and you know, Haddonfield Memorial. You actually get to walk through the pumpkin of the opening sequence. You get to smell pumpkin spice. You know, it's like that stuff is so refreshing. I have to say that Krampus wins hands down as best production design. Like, the best design, beautifully made, like, just very specific detail.
Not the scariest, but I wanted to live in it. Yes. I wanted to just walk through, like, and look at everything.
It was so cool.
Less scares, I think, because it's also set in more light. There's a lot more light in that one. But Halloween 2 was one. I mean,
Halloween 2
is one of my favorite.
I couldn't believe how awesome that
Exorcist.
Was.
I liked Exorcist. Exorcist was the scariest
that
one.
They're the two best. Both had great jumps.
Halloween 2, I wrote about Halloween 2 on the website. It's just because I love that sequel. It's one of my favorites of the franchise. So being able to go through it scene by scene pretty much is amazing. The other thing you have to keep in mind is Universal is one of the ones that goes out of their way, as Ryan said, with smells and yeah. just kind of like
temperature changes.
Temperature changes. So The Exorcist, for example, which was awesome, but I never until that night thought of what the house in The Exorcist must smell like. And it smelled pretty gnarly. And yeah, it smelled like vomit.
But not as bad as Chainsaw.
Chainsaw. Yeah, the Chainsaw was one was putrid.
Rancid.
Let me tell you, you go into Chainsaw Blood Brothers, which was kind of a takeoff of Texas Chainsaw 2, and you start out with the barbecue smell, which is okay. But there is one room with a corpse that I don't know what a dead body smells like, but I'm pretty sure it was that, because it was
gnarly.
Really gnarly.
Well, what I was going to say about Exorcist is what's cool about it is it wasn't a traditional maze. Like, you know, with the mazes that you go through a narrative. And here you go through a narrative, but you're going in a cycle.
It's the same room.
It's the same room.
And you're just going through the progression. Yeah.
It's not
really
like
cool.
a studio tour behind the scenes of the actual Exorcist. Yeah. Like, now you're going to that scene.
Right. You're going to different progression. You're going through the progression of her possession. But what was fun is that we went through the power of Christ compels you moment where Reagan's levitating off the bed. We've got the big group, and we just couldn't help ourselves. We were just stood around the bed, and we were going, the power of Christ compels you. Meanwhile, Father who was it?
Maron?
Father Maron's standing next to us, and he's like doing the arm wave, you know, and throwing the holy water. I thought he was a robot. Like, I thought he was so I'm going, the power of Christ compels you. And then also he turns, and he's like, you guys are doing really good. And we're like, we all ran out of the room, but it was a blast.
I have to say, one of my favorite parts of the night, even though that it was definitely, I mean, mazes are amazing, but we went to the Jabberwocky dance troupe because
Jabberwockies,
because I was covering it for the website.
That was your favorite part, huh?
No. My favorite part was their reaction.
Ryan, can you describe, because I didn't know what the hell it was. Describe what
it's
it is.
It's a dance troupe. Okay, no, so
describe
it's,
how you got us to go in.
Well, I'm covering
I heard this
it
is 10 minutes,
website.
And let's just go in at the end of the night.
Yeah, I heard it was brisk, and I wanted to cover it for the website. So I was like, let's just go in at the end of the night, guys. There's like an 11:15 show right as we're getting ready to leave. We'll just pop on in. And all I knew is that it was a dance troupe. I had seen them on America's Got Talent or one of the shows, and that they wore white masks, and that it was kind of like a hip-hoppy, dubsteppy thing.
This is how she sold us.
So I was like, okay, guys, well, I want to cover it for the website anyway because I want the full inclusive experience of the park. So we're going to go in, and it starts, and they start dancing, and then they start doing all this kind of like meditative poetry and
hip-hop,
spoken word.
Poetry.
And then I look over, and Rob and Elric's faces are just like,
can I tell you
not
my,
a fan of spoken word.
Can
are
I
you
tell
boys?
Can I tell you my review? As soon as it was over and the lights went up and we were walking out, I was like, I have a 3-word review for you. Yeah, I'm 40. Not for me.
So I do have to say, if I had been younger, I would have been like, man, that totally spoke to me. And it was fun to watch. There were definitely fun parts
to
watch.
If I was recommending someone to do it, though, I would do it at the start of the night to have fun. Get out of the way. It's got some energy. But don't do it at the end. If that's your last memory, I forgot all the mazes by the end. I looked at her and I said, you wiped my memory.
On the way out, they kept giving me shit. They were like, I can't believe you made us do this last. And I was like, I didn't know.
But that's not to take away from the mazes at all, which were spectacular.
Yeah, they were really well done.
Even even Freddy vs. Jason, you know, it had some really fun moments where they would both lunge at you from different endings, and you know, it was cool.
And let's not forget the Purge walkthrough experiences.
Uh-huh. You know? Yeah, that was a lot of fun.
Are we allowed to talk about my favorite aspect of the Purge walkthrough?
Was it the like go-go dancers?
The person in this room right now.
Oh yeah.
Can I reveal his identity?
I think so.
Our social media guy on Blumhouse.com, John Humphrey, is one of the Purge people when you're at Universal.
Yeah, just because he loves it so much, he keeps doing it.
And every year.
We were so inspired by it. Like, he was skipping around and running after people, and we were just like, how does he do this all the time?
Maybe 20 years ago I would have the energy.
I'm exhausted right now.
Well, we also left out American Horror Story, which was having its first kind of a like maze debut, and it took you through...
You went through Hotel and Murder House and Freak Show.
Yeah.
And I was kind of sad because they missed my two favorite, Asylum and Coven. And
Asylum could get its own one.
Yeah.
Like, Asylum is such a no-brainer.
So Coven.
I think so.
I don't know. I think Asylum, though, is that you've got a great location.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Nazis and stuff. I mean, that's just crazy.
Right.
Shockwave should have one. The real Shockwave. Yeah, that would be a
show.
Well, every year when I was at Shock, I used to do... Halloween Horror Nights mazes you'll never see. And it was like the Last House on the Left experience, you know, and then the full, the man, the, what do they call it? The Mad World of Lucio Fulci, where you just like walk through different experiences.
My favorite was Ghoulies. I wanted
to do Ghoulies versus Critters.
Yeah, Ghoulies versus Critters. Because I mean, and then you have to get through the toilet.
Well, we have a couple of recommendations that we'll show it throw
next
at
week.
Mr. Murdy.
I think
next
week. Yes,
we were trying to hold out. We're like, we're going to pitch Murdy our terrible ideas,
and he's going to love them, and he's going to be like, Universal owns that, and we're going to be like, yeah, you guys are doing it next year.
So yeah, that was fun. If you're anywhere near one of the parks, I'd recommend doing it.
Yeah.
Definitely. You know? Front of line, though.
Yeah, front of line's the way
to go. No question.
Yeah. Also taking place in town here is Beyond Fest. I've only hit one thing so far, so who's made it over to Beyond Fest?
I went to one thing.
Yeah, I went to
which
the,
was?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I went to Beyond the Wall.
Oh, okay.
Which I wanted to see because a lot of the stuff that they do are like retrospective screenings, which are awesome because everybody needs to see Street Trash on this big screen and Neon Maniacs and movies like that. But I really wanted to check out some of the newer stuff. So on Monday night, I went to see Beyond the Wall, which is a French miniseries. And they showed all three episodes. And it is about a girl who inherits a house from somebody that she's never heard of. And as soon as she gets into the house, she starts hearing stuff behind the wall. So she takes a sledgehammer and starts knocking down the wall and discovers this like maze that exists behind her wall. And it takes her into a whole nother house. And the house in this house that it takes her into, people have been trapped for like eons and they can't find their way out. There's no windows. The house is just continuous. You'll never be in the same room twice.
Wow.
Hundreds of people are trapped in there, but the longer you get trapped, the more crazy you become. And the house tries to trick you to get you to stay there. So you see like memories of your past, dead people that you love, people chasing you, things like that. And it's all about her trying to get back out.
Yeah. So. Everett McGill's really good in it. He wears a gimp suit in one scene.
I got all excited. I was like, Everett McGill!
It's really sweet. Like Spencer, even at the opening, he was like, I cried. And midway through, this is a little sad.
The cool thing, I haven't seen it, but the cool thing is if you get Shudder, it is about to be on Shudder. Mm-hmm. And Shudder was the sponsor of the small room at Beyond Fest. So all the free screenings of new filmmakers like Bertino. There's a couple really interesting. I don't know if Raw's in the small theater.
Autopsy Agenda.
They dumped that to the big room.
Because that did so well, fantastic.
Yeah, I can't wait to see that
one. Going to that on Monday, actually.
Yeah. Friday.
Oh, Friday, yeah, after Bed Batch. So if you have Shudder, I think it's going to be on there, like ASAP.
And it was, I mean, it's definitely like a slower, I can't even call it slower pace because they're constantly moving. Like it never stops moving. Mm. It's definitely got a sentimental tone to it. The soundtrack's amazing. Like, just gorgeous soundtrack. I recommend it. I really enjoyed it.
Right on.
So, yeah. What else did you guys see at Beyond Fest?
Well, you did the Phantasm.
I did I'm wearing the shirt. I got the Mondo shirt for the remaster. Look, Phantasm is a film I've been so excited about this eventual restoration, you know?
Well, you've been waiting to see it on the big screen for this, pretty much.
And I saw it with you at the thing, but it wasn't really the same, right? Because the cast and crew at Texas Frightmare were kind of talking a little
bit. Live commentary.
And the print was pretty good, but this is really different. I mean, this print, it looks gorgeous. It sounds incredible. And I was thinking back to when I first saw it on VHS, and I remember there's a couple scenes where there's only a little bit of light on their faces. Even when you watch it now, it's shot dark, you know? Yeah. And it was just black. Like I remember seeing that movie and thinking whole sequences were just darkness, nothing actually happening. And to see it in this way, except for the kind of more surreal parts when he's in the white room at the end, to see it like this just felt, it's such an imaginative, wild little movie. And it was a great experience, a great night. And it was like such a cool Angus Scrimm tribute because everyone was there. This was the Egyptian, the oldest theater in Hollywood. Thing is packed. I'm not even kidding. I haven't seen a line like that personally since like seeing old photos of when people went to Star Wars in LA about the Chinese man. This line went all the way down the side street of Hollywood and all the way around the corner. It was literally a blockbuster. Wow. And you're like, this is fucking Phantasm. Like, it was kind of ludicrous. So that was really cool. And they did, you know, Q&A. And the between is fun, and Don, everyone was there. And then before Ravager starts, and we'll be asking our guests soon about this, and I'll save my Ravager comments for our actual episode. But he made some. I don't know if he made it for your screening, but
it's online now.
Oh, yeah.
It is so perfect. He made a video basically summarizing if you haven't seen the other films, and it's really funny.
Yeah, it's like Cliff Notes edition. Perfectly catching you up on the Phantasm series. And what's great about it is that they use footage from 1, 3, and 4 That's right. And then they redact any footage from Phantasm 2 because they do not have the rights. Yeah,
but they have his 5-year-old niece or something. Like, there's stick figures that come up. Really funny. Like art.
Yeah. Really,
but it was really fun. And regardless, it was like that part of the night felt like the love letter part. It felt like the actual farewell to Angus. Everyone kind of was applauding at the end.
Aww.
And you just, you know, it's like, wow, the movies are, you know, if you're Coscarelli, you never would be thinking when you made that movie that all these years later,
40 years later,
it'd still have legs of some kind, no matter what they are, you know?
Yeah.
So that was a great night. And that I'm going back. I've got a lot. This is the weekend where I'm seeing more stuff. So I haven't been back
yet. I'm seeing Monster on Thursday. I'm seeing Autopsy of Jane Doe and Sudoku versus
Kayako.
Thank you.
That's Friday.
On Friday, Saturday, I'm seeing Raw. So yeah, there's a lot.
Are staying for Dawn of the Dead?
Probably Dawn of the Dead 3D. I'm going to that.
Yeah.
I can't wait.
To hear what you guys say.
We had just brought that up like 2 weeks ago.
I know.
What happened to it?
Yeah, literally the day after we were talking about it, then they announced, oh, hey, we're showing that Dawn of the Dead 3D.
There's no movie I want to miss more than that and then ask everyone about. And if it's good,
you and Brian Collins.
I just can't do it. I'm going to New Bedford for the whole night, so I'm going to, but I'll be excited to hear.
Please tweet.
That's my birthday night.
You want to know all the movies?
I'm going to Raw, and then after that, I'm going to go like have pancakes.
You're sleep by yourself.
I have
you're gonna be by yourself.
Why should I have
be
by chill, yourself? Yeah. I have a husband and children that wake me up at 5 a.m. He's angry.
Happy.
Happy. So sad.
I'll bring cake to the show next week and make you assholes have cupcakes with me.
We're going to do that because happy belated birthday to Ryan.
Oh, thanks.
Welcome to the 40 Club, pal.
Yeah.
Sorry. I'm no longer the oldest one here.
Spoiler.
And Becca's birthday's coming up this week.
Yeah.
41.
I am not
either.
I am not 40, but I have a year or two.
We'll try to celebrate next week.
Yeah.
For me, I went to see The Beyond at Beyond Fest.
Wait, again?
You're so lucky.
Did you make it through this time?
Yes, I did. But no, the special thing with this was the composer's cut. This is
the Frizzy.
It was Fabio Frizzy performing. He did a concert last year.
It's amazing.
Which was great.
And it was literally a concert of all his themes from all the Fulci stuff. This was really unique and special. Well, first of all, they kicked it off as a bonus. Bruce Campbell came out and introduced the opening episode of season 2 for Ash versus Evil Dead, which also premiered that night. And that was really fun to watch it with an audience. Just wait till episode 2. I'm telling you, there's some hardcore.
That's pretty nuts.
Yeah, now you know what I'm talking about. Yeah. It's going to get really nuts. But then what happened was, you know, normally they do some of these quote-unquote live scores. And I'm usually hit or miss on them because when a band is playing live, it also makes it difficult to hear the dialogue if they do it that way. But what's great is that Bob Murawski was there from Grindhouse Releasing. And he provided, I assume because he owns The Beyond now, he provided them with a pristine high-def version that had the dialogue and sound effects, but not the music.
Whoa.
What?
So they were able to kind of properly mix the dialogue.
That's so Murawski if you weren't seeing of him.
It. It's very Murawski. and then Fabio Frizzy had his whole band there, and they played it live. The cool thing about this is it wasn't like he just did the whole score live. Like, the main themes were there. He wrote a brand new theme. So this is as if he was rescoring it.
Did
now
he say
today.
Why? Did, why his impulse was to do that?
No, from what I understand is he wrote, as I assume a lot of composers do, he wrote several themes for this. So this was a theme, I believe, that was originally, I don't want to say rejected, but I guess that, you know, he wrote more music than Fulci wanted for it, apparently. And again, I'm just guessing based on, you know, how this event transpired. But the new theme is beautiful. And honestly, normally I have trouble following Fulci movies. For whatever reason, this was the best time I've ever seen The Beyond.
Yeah. Wow.
And I don't know
he's
if
like
it was just
live, a component actually brought clarity to
yeah,
it.
Yeah, he's suddenly.
No, like I
get
totally
the
can
thing.
Follow it.
He's like, I could see between the frames and understand the story.
No, like literally, I was like, oh, that's the plumber. Oh, now that's the plumber's wife.
Yeah.
And that's the plumber's wife daughter. Oh my God, I get this finally. Like, it was unbelievable.
The little red haired girl with the acid dumped on her.
Yeah, so I was like, oh, but she's related to that. Okay, got it.
Well, next year when he comes to score Cat in the Brain. Get prepared for a headache.
And here's the thing. I would not be surprised at all if somebody's bound to release this on vinyl, like a composer's cut version of these themes.
Death Waltz will probably do it.
I'm surprised they didn't do it in advance of, like, bring
I know,
it and be
I know.
Ready to
and,
drop it.
But. And Murawski and his crew from Grindhouse Releasing were shooting it So I wouldn't be surprised.
Weird. I wonder what else they could be.
I don't know, but they also shot the performance last year. So I wouldn't be surprised to send it up as a bonus feature on some Grindhouse release or maybe a re-release of The Beyond with an alternate score.
And straight up, if you haven't heard our killer POV episode with Murawski, it's probably my number one.
One of the best.
It was definitely one of my favorites to hear and live.
We should get him back on this one.
Fantastic guy. Look him up if you don't know what he's been doing besides just his editing for Raimi.
An Oscar award winning.
Yeah. Great film mind.
So that's it for Beyond.
I'm
Fest.
Jealous on that one, buddy. I gotta say, I own
these really great.
I feel like I missed out. Now
I just rewatched it like a month before, so I was like, you know what, I don't need to see Beyond.
And by the way, it was paired up with City of the Living Dead. So
I should have just brought.
I was gonna stay at least to catch the beginning of it. Here's the thing: unfortunately, I love those guys, but they were a little bit late on everything.
Everything.
The Egyptian.
I missed Ryan's birthday because of them.
Yeah, pretty much.
Blame them.
But no, the reason is because honestly, after I think Frizzy kind of improvised and said, yeah, I want to play a set now. So he actually stayed and played cool. some more themes on top of it, much to Spencer was, Hickman was like pacing back and forth. I think I could see it was like, oh man, they've only got this place probably till midnight.
No, yeah, probably.
But it was super cool. It was, I really thought it was special. And I know, Ryan was saying, well, we saw him last year. This was different. And it was,
I hadn't realized. I undersold it. I didn't realize that
it was
that
cool.
I should have brought my folks. I should have brought my mom. Who was in town? My folks were in town. I should have just been like, Mom, Dad,
we're going to the Beyond.
We're going to go see the Beyond.
Yeah, it was cool.
My mind will get blown.
Has your dad seen the Beyond? He's seen a lot of horror.
I'm sure he's seen it. Yeah. Like he probably saw it, at some drive-in at one point.
Yeah.
But,
what have you seen?
Well, it's October, so we've all been kind of doing our day-by-day Halloween horror kind of lineup,
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll work backwards. I rewatched The Howling last night.
Uh-oh.
Let's get real. Real talk about The Howling.
Real talk, okay. Ryan Turek.
So Howling, I haven't seen in a couple of years. I've always respected it. My dad introduced it to me on Laserdisc because that was really cool because the werewolves were cool. I love the transformation. Watching it now at the age of 40, it is not Dante's best.
No,
it is really, if you look at his oeuvre, it is really early Dante. He's still trying to figure it out. Like he's still trying to figure out what he's about and who he is. And The Howling, it's it's funny because we had like a mini debate on my Facebook page about it because somebody was like, I'll take The Howling over American Werewolf any day. And I'm like,
I don't agree with that at all.
Yeah. On pure filmmaking, on pure writing, on pure all of it, American Werewolf blows Howling out of the water. But even just as a film, The Howling just does it's got great promise, but the follow through doesn't work. It's really clunky.
Well, and it's like Dante basically created almost like his own tone overall, like in the long run of his career.
That's what I'm talking about.
Between dark and funny, and it's perfectly melded.
Yeah.
But in this one, it's dark, then funny.
Yes.
Then dark and funny.
And even the funny.
It's very different.
Yeah. And even the funny doesn't work.
No, like the dark stuff in that movie is fucking scary. Like the opening sequence, there's stuff in that. I think the opening and a little bit in the middle and the end, there's enough in there to make me still interested in this movie because like the opening stuff with the killer and the porn theater, all that stuff is really unsettling. But then when he tries to make it lighter, it's really hard to go light.
Yeah, because I mean, like when Dee Wallace is watching the kind of snuff movie that's playing out in the peep show, you're like, this is really grim.
Yeah.
This is
really
great. But I mean, granted, visually, there's a lot of interesting stuff that he plays with. But you're right. It's a tonal thing that he's trying to figure out. And he's fighting against his true nature, I feel, in that entire movie, which is kind of thematic to the film itself.
Well, then Burbs and Gremlins, you see it in perfect harmony. Like how you can do comedy and darkness at the same time.
Yeah.
And not many people can do
and
it.
And again, this is people who are listening, even Joe, if he's listening, it's just like there's no disrespect to that.
Yeah,
it's just in terms of the larger
– podcast?
I don't know. You always have to preface it with that stuff because it's like I'm not bashing it. It's just – I've always been a fan. It's just like I'm seeing it with new eyes and I'm like – okay, this has got some warts on it.
And your big transformation scene where it really highlights the difference of that year when both guys were working on it because in American Werewolf where they show it in light and it's just beautifully made and it's still like disturbing.
It still is gorgeous.
And in this one they have to hold on the shot way past the point of it actually being interesting or scary, but it's still funny and weird.
It's cool. It's cool to see. But
I still like that movie and I love the score. Pina D'Agia's score.
Pino's score is great. But there's a little bit of weirdness in it. Like there's a it's funny because I listened to it on I have the record for it and I listened to it. And I'm like, where does that track come in? I don't remember that weirdo, goofy track. And it's when the one brother with the kind of fur pelt thing over his shoulders is like hunting and he's looking, he's tracking, and you hear this like weird little theme. I'm like, oh, this is supposed to be funny. This is the funny track.
Exactly,
So I watched that. I did working backwards. I watched Elvira, Mistress of the Dark, which I always love.
I will do the rap for you someday.
Oh, thank you. And then Poltergeist 2, which is a mess in and of itself.
Three.
You guys are way out of your minds.
No. Three's where it's at.
We'll get to something good, which is Sleepy Hollow.
Cool.
I watched that this week, too.
I haven't seen Sleepy Hollow in a couple of years.
First question, is that the last Great Burden? I'm trying to think since that if there's been anything.
I think so, although I'm going to talk about the new movie.
Wait, Big Fish. Yeah. Was that before or after?
Big Fish is good.
Big Fish is great.
Sleepy Hollow is amazing. Sleepy Hollow is
really solid. It's narratively speaking, it's a little all over the place, and it kind of gets a little murky, but as a pure atmosphere, cool, creepy Burton movie. It's like you couldn't have a better pairing. Andrew Kevin Walker on the script, Tim Burton.
Kevin Yeager, too, on the story.
I remember reading the script for Sleepy Hollow like really early on, and I was like, this thing is dry. I have no idea how they're going to make this. And then you see what Tim Burton brought to it. But it's like, there's a lot of Burton-esque stuff in there. Yeah.
Walken with that.
If anything, I actually would have loved to have seen them play with Christina Ricci's kind of witchcraft element a little bit more. You know, heighten that. But it's a cool movie.
Plus, like the beheadings, like the horror of it is so good.
Well, he was kind of playing to the Hammer horror aesthetic, so it plays. Mm-hmm. The blood looks a certain way. The bodies look a certain way. You know,
that's right before Sweeney Todd, right? And then he kind of did Sweeney.
Yes.
And Sweeney's got some great stuff but Sleepy Hollow is it, and it's a great Halloween movie to watch. You're right. Yeah, like a perfect.
Yeah. Oh, it's perfect. You got the pumpkins and all that stuff. Yeah, you know what? You're right. I'm actually going to back you and say that's probably the last great thing he's done.
Yeah.
I went and saw his new movie, which I can't even pronounce, Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children, which I just call Peculiar Children. And apparently it's based on a series of novels by Ransom Riggs. I actually really, really like this film. And, you know, again, because Burton hasn't had the best track record in the last decade or whatever, but I love, you know, I unapologetically love his first half of his career. I thought this was cool. This is super quirky and weird. And
the book series is awesome. I'm excited to see the film.
The film's good. It clocks in a little over 2 hours.
Ouch.
And the only problem with that, it's not really a problem. I mean, you know, we used to be used to this with the movies. Mm-hmm. It's very dense. They're cramming in a lot of story into this 2 hours. And part of me almost felt like, man, this would be a really great, series as opposed to one movie. But that said, it you know, and I don't know what Burton's deal is, but I miss his sensibilities in these things, like the quirky characters and the humor that he has. I contributed to Birth Movies Death's issue of Tim Burton saying that, you know, Batman Returns is kind of like one of his most Tim Burton movies ever. And this definitely returns to that. It's not great, but I thought it was really, really good and probably the most solid movie he's made since like Sleepy Hollow.
Wow.
So I really liked the new one.
But my concern is, the trailers always make it look like he works with way too much CGI these days, but I don't know.
Yeah, no, I thought there was a good balance of it. There's some good kind of spooky, scary stuff in it. I didn't see anything. I went in blind, and I was pleasantly surprised.
I was also concerned that since he was covering somebody else's material, that it was going to end up like Dark Shadows, where he was trying to shove way too much textual background into film.
Dark Shadows is a tonal mess.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if it's supposed to be scary or funny or what. This is definitely consistently Burton through and through. It's got a lot of Big Fish in it, but with, you know, I mean, it's all a bunch of weird kids that are at a school together. It's totally, it's like,
I feel like I dreamt like Dark Shadows.
Yeah.
Like, I don't remember it. It's like, oh, Eva Green was blonde in that.
Yeah.
That's right.
And she's great in this one, too.
I'll watch it just for Eva Green now.
Yeah. No, it's super. It's like Tim Burton trying to do like an X-Men First Class sort of deal.
Yeah.
So I really liked it. What else did you guys see?
Well, you go first.
Oh, okay. So I've been doing a series of lists for Blumhouse on the scariest films from all of these different decades.
Becca, thank you for that, by the way.
For the 50s one.
No, I say that genuinely because I know we've talked about, you know, having run a website and, you know, what people want. And it's like there is a thing out there where people don't believe that horror movies existed before 1968, which is the Rosemary's Baby year.
Yeah.
Because everybody uses that as an example. But it's like there are great great horror movies before then.
And
so
I
you've been bringing
that.
Those to attention.
Yeah, and we've done 1920s stuff. Dave did a whole bunch of stuff on pre-code horror, so we've been really trying to push it. And I will say, it definitely does not do as well as if I post up like the top films of the 1980s or something like that. But, and I address it in the one that's going up tomorrow is on the 1960s, and I talk about how, you know, everyone looks at 68 as the changing year. But for me, I think 1960 was one of the big changing years because that's when we saw Black Sunday and Peeping Tom. And that's when things like really started getting dark for me. But I watched 1961's Night Tide, which I had not seen. Like I apparently watched it at some point in college, but
Curtis
had not
Harrington.
Seen it in forever. Yeah. Curtis Harrington.
Sounds like a Meatloaf song.
Night Tide.
Dennis Hopper, Curtis Harrington.
It is very young Dennis Hopper. Yeah, not at the start of his career by any means, because he'd done like Rebel Without a Cause and Giant by this point.
Kind of Carnival Souls-ish.
Yeah, very. So it's set in Venice Beach, and he plays this young sailor on leave, and he falls in love with this girl who plays a mermaid in the carnival. But after a while, he becomes convinced that she's actually a real mermaid who is killing people with the cycle of the moon. But the whole thing is in this kind of carnival backdrop, but it's got beatniks in it and jazz musicians, and it's really sleazy and seedy at the same time. Really cheaply made, but it's so atmospheric. It's gorgeous.
He's one of those guys who people really love. Like people before our generation, they all remember this guy. He did Who Slew Auntie Rue, or you know, there's two movies that ripped off Whatever Happened to Babe Jane. One is Who Slew Auntie
Rue. Hush, Sweet Charlotte.
Hush, Hush. Okay, Hush, Hush was by, I think that was by this
it was by
Aldrich,
the same guy. Yeah.
So he did Who Slew Auntie Rue. He's an interesting director, but towards the end of his life, he was kind of one of those guys who was like Kenneth Anger, who was an expert on old Hollywood. He knew everything about everyone. And at the end of his career, like about 10 years ago, which is when he died, he dressed up like Edgar Allan Poe and did like these Edgar Allan Poe shorts at the end. I don't know if they're available, but I remember reading an article about it at the time and getting so excited, wanting to track them down. And that's how I found Night Tide. He sounds like a really unique, like, part of film history.
Yeah.
Kind of character,
and you know? Night Tide in general, it's very low budget and it's very kind of homespun, and it really focuses on the atmosphere just as much as it does the characters in that regard. It felt like Habit if you picked up Habit and put it in 1960s
right,
Venice
at the time.
Beach.
That makes sense.
Because it's very focused on the art scene and the sleaze of the art scene and everything.
Bucket of Blood has that a little bit too.
Yeah, it does. It definitely does. So I highly recommend checking it out. I was really shocked by how much I loved it.
My only beef to – I agree. Your list of the 1950s was fantastic list of movies. But my only bone was Eyes Without a Face, baby. That's
1960s.
No, it's not. It's 1959.
It's 1960s because it's on my list for tomorrow.
Well, you're wrong, because I looked it up when you did your 50s list and it said 1959 France, but maybe in America it was 1960.
Okay, because it's on my list for
tomorrow. It doesn't really matter. It doesn't matter. As long as it's on the list.
It's like a Dead Right Horror trivia argument.
We're going to get
We're arm
here.
Wrestling over the top over here.
1960.
Either way, it's great. But that was a good list. There's some great movies in
thank
there.
Thank you. And I've been kind of torn because, like, for my one that I'm doing tomorrow, which will come out on Thursday, which will already be up by the time this airs. So, like, the movies that scare me the most are not things like Rosemary's Baby, but I feel like I need to put Rosemary's Baby on there because it scares a lot of people. But, like, why can't I remember the name of it? Bunny Lane. Bunny Lane is missing.
Bunny Lake.
Bunny Lake, thank you, is missing. Scared the shit out of me when I first saw it. So, like, I want to put that on there, or Quaidon, or films like that. So, it's been...
That's so subjective what scares you. That's why your list is a little different, because you weren't just saying the best 10 films, you're saying what's scariest.
Yes.
And that's a little different.
Completely. Yeah. Like, Lady in a Cage is another one that, like, when I saw it, it was, like, very, very shocking for me, but a lot of people don't find
some
that
dude with
scary.
A lady in his cage isn't scared of that. It's like, that's Saturday.
So the other thing that I watched, and this will fly well over Robin Elric's head, because when I've talked about Rocky Horror, Ryan might be with me, but when I've talked about Rocky Horror in
asleep.
Past, you guys are like out completely.
Yep.
But I saw the Rocky Horror remake that's airing on Fox on October 20th. Oh,
eyes glaze over.
Guys, come on.
Sullenly sits back in chair and drinks beer.
It does not feel nearly as dangerous or sleazy as I know Fox doing that as the first one did. They definitely give the music an update, which in some songs it's kind of like, hey, this is kind of peppy. The girl who plays Columbia in it, Anna Lee Ashford, is amazing. She was like one of the best parts of it for me. But otherwise, it just did not have the same kind of dangerous feel as the first one.
I don't know. What are you? Is this a TV thing? I didn't miss the whole part.
It was a TV thing.
I mean, I heard Rocky Horror, but okay.
they were having success by doing stuff like Grease and The Wiz.
They did Wizard of Oz.
Okay,
yeah.
Like Grease with that last.
Or The Wiz, thank you.
Yeah. But I mean, like, you know, Rocky Horror was such a thing, you know, and it's hard to emulate that, and they keep trying.
Yeah,
and, it's like,
and
stop.
The weird one about the remake is they do cutaways of people in the audience cheering, and so it gets really meta.
What?
And with that, it kind of loses, like, because it'll cut occasionally to, like, this audience full of punk gothy kids all screaming the callback lines. Of course, not any of the good callback lines, because you can't run those on public television. So it gets kind of meta, and whereas the first Rocky Horror had this feeling of dangerousness, like these two kids clearly plucked out of, like, 1950s atomic films
never
being dropped
danger.
Into, like, this sexual situation. With this one, it was very much like, ooh, honey, look, goths. And it was just, it felt
meta
weird.
Means talking about it. So this sounds more like just bad, like breaking the fourth wall accidentally and showing a cheering fan.
Involving the, it's kind of like, what's that, the shadow, what do they call it? Shadow cast?
The shadow cast. That's what a Rocky Horror is a shadow
cast.
Yeah,
it's like, that's just not my bad.
I guarantee that some younger generations will probably watch this and it will capture people who will not have seen the original and who have not been to
movie. Crypt guys.
I'm 40.
Oh my god.
I'll do your shadow cast and listen.
I'm 40.
I hate
this.
Cosplayers and shadow casting. I hate fun.
Get on my lawn.
I've threatened for like the past 3 years on my birthday that I'm going to make you guys come with
That's
me to Rocky Horror. Yeah, it's like a year anniversary again,
okay,
guys.
Okay, here's I'm going to throw down when you turn 40. I'll go to that.
That's like a couple of years from now.
Okay, sure it is.
But she's a mom.
Yeah.
I'm a mom, guys. No.
I got to throw in about a remake, a special remake, a little special film I like to call... I don't know who made this, who's responsible. I don't know if any studios backed into this at all. But the Martyrs remake is a movie that I bet a few of you are at least curious. Like, I wonder if I should check that out. You know,
I'm curious.
Some people are like, that film's intense, but maybe an American version would be more fun. This is actually, I'm going to go on record and say it might be the biggest misfire of any remake I've ever seen, because even Nightmare on Elm Street, even though it gets certain things just way wrong, there's certain atmospheric sequences in it. This film basically misses the entire idea and the fact that Martyrs is a film that's all about an idea, not so much a story. It's about an actual idea, right? That you're going to reach this transcendent place through torture. People are going to try to find out about the afterlife, blah, blah, blah. In this film, it's the most vanilla fucking remake in the history of remakes. Like, basically, instead of de-skinning the person, spoiler, but never watch this fucking movie, so who cares? Spoiler, instead of skinning her, they take one little piece of skin off her back, and the rest, she's wearing clothes at the fucking end. Her friend doesn't even die, the main character. So the whole point of this movie, to me, is that it's the original Martyrs and its powers, that it's a fucking love story between these two girls, whether it's that kind of love or not. They care about each other deeply. It's about victimhood, right? And in that story, one of them, who starts the movie off and who can't stop seeing these monsters because of the abuse she suffered, you know, kills herself. And it's really tragic. And you're at the halfway point of a movie and you're like, oh, fuck, what do we do now? And then you watch this other character achieve this transcendence. And this movie, that character, oh, no, she lives. She got a little hurt, but she's okay. And then she goes downstairs. Instead of a weird monster woman in a basement, right, who's all tortured that they let go, it's a little fucking pretty girl in a little dress. And they say, run away. And she runs out. And it's all shot really beautifully. And you're like, what the fuck were these people even thinking? And there's like literally no reason for this thing to exist. And I'm not a big, look, I'm a fan of the Evil Dead remake, so I'm not a hater on remakes. Mm-hmm. But if you miss the idea of the film so much, I was questioning, what is this movie? Like, I don't know what you're trying to make that's not hardcore. It's not hitting the controversial button.
Well, what if you ignore or pretend you've never seen the original? Does it work on that level?
Okay, so obviously I just seen the original for this is all for a specific reason. But it wasn't at all enjoyable. Here's the thing, and the reason why I know this is I actually liked these directors, the film they just made before, which was the one on the road with Josh Duhamel, and he's on a street and he goes all crazy and he's stuck in the desert. I'll remember it's like Slow Burn or something like that.
Yeah, and it was,
you know, it wasn't my favorite movie, but it was like kind of entertaining and wacky and stuff. This movie, I don't know, it's hard, actually, probably too hard for me to really say. Yes, somebody might enjoy this movie.
Cynic Root.
Somebody might enjoy it if they hadn't seen the original, but I don't think so because it's so vanilla and the stakes are so low, and it's got people like Toby Huss. They'll come in for like two scenes, totally wasted, and you're like, you're using this fucking great actor, walks in, does two lines. There's something about the original that I talked about last week that I have a whole new appreciation after this week of like really studying it, which I hadn't done before. And like I said, I saw it between Saw 4 and 5. That's when it came out. Yeah. So it came out as one of those movies. It's a powerful fucking movie, and this thing is a real turd. And it just isn't fun at all.
Don't hold back, Elric.
So miss that. Skip straight to two TV shows. I won't even talk about that. Exorcist is, to me, just getting better.
It's wonderful.
Love the second episode. I hope people are tuning. It's how many episodes?
The third is amazing.
How many are you going to see?
I don't know. I've only saw listing for 5 or 6, but I think it is going to be.
I hope it's more because it was really cool. So. Yeah. I'm really digging it. And I thought the pilot of Westworld was fucking rad.
Oh, I haven't seen it yet.
I love the Westworld. Also, movie, but I love the West.
I just want to throw in on Scream Queens. Scream Queens came back to Fox.
Really? No.
I cracked up at the first season. I'm not the only one, guys. I'm not the only one. Sam Zimmerman and Brian Cousins are on Team Scream Queens.
Get out of here.
they're back. It's funny.
I hated the pilot, though. The pilot of the first one.
I couldn't even get through the pilot of the first one either. Yeah.
And they have a better villain this time, the Green Meanie. He's like a demon-looking thing. Let me have my
Well, okay, so you asked me, would anyone like the Martyrs remake? He might like it based on some of that.
That's where I throw my bloody napkin.
I'll drop American Horror Story. I'm still really into that.
Yeah, it's really good.
It's progressing, I'm still
Have you heard the story that, I don't know if you guys floated this or if it's just out there, that episode 6, it all changes?
I have not.
Okay, that's all I've heard.
I heard rumors.
That the entire structure and story is radically different after 6. So
okay.
We'll see.
What you see, Rob?
Oh, no, we covered everything that I saw pretty much.
Jesus, Becca.
The only thing I'm going to throw out.
What the fuck?
Well, no, I mean, as we were going along, that's how this works. Hmm. The only thing I want to add to that, because there's a new, I think it's Arrow is putting out a new Blu-ray of Donnie Darko.
Oh, cool.
And I was just interviewed for the new documentary
as a
movie fan.
Nice.
I love the movie. But
film historian, Rob G?
Yeah, there you go. Well, that's your title.
I don't know
what I'm getting. But it is a Halloween movie. It takes place in October, and literally ends on Halloween. I had not seen this movie in a long time, and it still really holds up, and I really think it's a great film. The thing I wanted to point out this time is I actually watched the director's cut, which when that came out, I did not like at all. And that's basically the general consensus is everyone's like, why'd they do this director's cut with, you know, all these extra rules of time travel and pages from the book. And actually the most jarring thing about the director's cut is all the musical choices are switched around. Hmm. So you're used to a certain song opening up a movie, and then all of a sudden it's a completely different song. You're like, wait, I don't get the vibes off. So I remember not really appreciating the director's cut, but with a lot of room between the last time I saw it, I just went straight to that version. And I actually kind of liked it, mainly because I wasn't comparing it to the last movie. And you have to remember, this movie came out literally a month after like 9/11 happened. So it didn't get its cult following until another year later. 2002 became a cult hit. The director's cut came out in 2004. So like really fast in this short period of time was where we're getting multiple cuts of this movie and all that stuff. I think it's interesting in retrospect now. I don't really need more of the explanation stuff, but what stood out to me about the director's cut this time was there was a lot of cool little character moments between the family that were all deleted. And I'm sure they were deleted for time and stuff. But for example, like there's a great scene with Donnie Darko and his father, Eddie Darko, as they're just having a conversation out on the on the patio, or whatever. Mm-hmm. And he asks him something like, "Oh, how do you feel having a nutcase for a son?" And he's just like, "Well, you're the only son I have." Mm-hmm. And they start laughing. It's just like these great little character moments that make that movie as good as it is. So,
is it as good as S. Darko? I've never seen the sequel.
S. Darko's rough.
I've heard it's bad.
Yeah, I watched it. But speaking of the Martyrs Room, it's like S. Darko misses everything that's great feeling about the original completely.
I had disregarded the original because by the time I saw it had like taken over Hot Topic and I was like, oh, what's this? But
sometimes that happens for a reason. A movie's really good.
And you're not the first person to say that this week to me, and I'm like, you got to go and rewatch it because it's a great movie.
I actually did after we ran an article on the site a couple of months back that was called Decoding Donnie Darko. And it was where, I don't even remember which one of our fantastic authors wrote it, but somebody went through and like broke down all the cues and talked about what it meant in the book and everything like that. And so I went back and rewatched it, but I watched the director's cut and I loved it. I thought it was amazing. Like, it
go back to the theatrical
me.
Now.
Okay. Going back to the theatrical
is better. But I will say one last thing before we move on. The one thing that it made me realize going back to Donnie Darko is there's only one other movie that I've seen do it, and it did do it as successful. But speaking about Blair Witch, because Blair Witch was 99, that was the first viral sensation. Like, that was the movie that everybody went online and investigated. Donnie Darko is the only other movie that I could think of that did that. 2002, there was a huge thing with their website where you'd have to click around to find pages from the time travel, Roberta Sparrow's book. Because all my friends were really into it. Right. So there are all these clues and things that gave the backstory and revealed, like, you know, you could find an article, a newspaper article on the website about the teacher that was played by Noah, whatever his name is.
Noah Wiley.
Like, he dies in a car accident like 5 years later. There's a newspaper article of it. So that was the only other movie that I remember having a huge,
do people want
strong,
that, though? I don't.
No, well this was that one they did. And here's my point. The director's cut actually shot and incorporated stuff from the website into it.
I think that's one of the problems with Southland is that it has all of this other things and comics and tie-ins. And I watched the movie and go,
But Southland was a really confusing mess.
I know, but that's the problem. Yeah, I have to make a movie, you know?
All righty. Well, that's the latest, and we're going to bring our guest on.
Speaking of part fives, let's do it.
It's no secret we at Shockwaves are huge fans of horror, on film, on TV, and especially in person. Halloween Horror Nights at Universal Studios Hollywood brings together the sickest minds in horror to immerse guests in a living, breathing, three-dimensional world of terror. Now through November 5th, 2016, Halloween Horror Nights features a new slate of unrivaled film and television production quality mazes, frightful scare zones, and a fully reimagined terror tram experience, all uniquely themed to today's most definitive horror properties, like The Exorcist, American Horror Story, Halloween, Hell Comes to Haddonfield, Freddy vs. Jason, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Krampus, The Walking Dead, and The Purge Election Year. These mazes are scary as hell, and we will be telling you about each of them in graphic detail over the next few weeks. As Southern California's most extreme Halloween event, Halloween Horror Nights is designed to taunt, terrorize, and torment guests as they navigate the darkness from one frightening maze to another. Tickets are available for purchase at www.halloweenhorrornights.com/Hollywood, including a front-of-line ticket option that enables guests to enjoy priority access to each of the Halloween Horror Nights mazes and the Terror Tram, a theme park ride. Advance purchase is recommended as events nights will sell out. Halloween Horror Nights at Universal Studios Hollywood. Nobody does Halloween better. Visit HalloweenHorrorNights.com/Hollywood now for more info and to get your tickets.
All righty, and welcome back to the show. We are very excited because I was just telling our guests this. The coolest thing was sitting in front of my TV, bringing up Voodoo, and being able to click yes on a new Phantasm movie and just watch it like instantly.
Yeah.
So right now, Phantasm, the 4K restoration of the original is out digitally, not on Blu-ray yet, digitally, and it's going to be theatrical along with Phantasm Ravager, directed by our guest, David Hartman.
Thank you.
Hi.
Thank you. Hey, guys.
Welcome aboard.
How are you, man?
I'm on cloud nine right now.
It's a long journey finally coming to a close.
It really has. I mean, we've spent years, as most of you have heard on this, so I'm kind of at this point now, you know, like where I'm talking to Don every day going, oh, hi, Don. And he's like, hey, what's up? It's like, nothing really. I've been calling you about 7 times a day for the last several years.
So how long has this project been going on from like the very inkling of I want to do something to now?
I mean, it's been several years, but there was time taken off in the middle,
right.
Which, you know, I don't know if you guys want to go into this later, but it started out as a web series.
Yeah.
Or not even that. It was just camera tests, you know, and it was like, 1080p was just available, and it was like, oh my god, you know, that's only $10,000 for that camera.
And there was, and I remember at the time, you know, I was running, I think it was either Dread Central or I was at Shock, but I remember we ran like a story that was just Reggie hanging out, what looked like Griffith Park, you know, holding the gun, and it was like somebody just sent us an email saying, something in the Phantasm world is afoot. And I was like,
I remember that.
And I was like, oh my God, what is it? And then, you know, and I had heard about the web series developments. Yeah.
Well, and we were trying to keep the whole thing secret.
Good job with that.
Well, yeah. You know, and that was one of our biggest accomplishments. Right. That's how I saw movies as a kid. You know, when I see a trailer in the movies and it's like, holy cow, I can't wait to see that. Right. You know, now it's a lot of hype. It's a lot of hype. And then you're like, oh, man, I've been reading about this. Oh, the trailer just got released.
You guys still did a good job with it, though. Yeah. I feel like there was enough, like, downtime and then kind of cool.
A lot of downtime.
You know, like, and you kept the fans involved, which was really important for us.
Well, that's who we made it for. Yeah. You know, I'm a fan of the series ever since I was, like, 7. So, you know, it's a dream come true for me.
So, David, going back a little bit, you know, my exposure to your work, because you're a fantastic artist in and of yourself, you have a couple of books you brought for us here. I remember being exposed to your artwork through Rob Zombie. Mm-hmm. You had done a lot of artwork for Rob, and I remember going to Rob Zombie's concerts and seeing your artwork on a shirt, and I was like, who is this guy?
Wow.
This stuff is really, really sweet. And then I would just kind of keep digging, and I think the one image that you had done was of the prophecy bear. It was a girl it was a girl coming out of a lake and crawling up onto a dock, and a prophecy bear standing there in the
mist. I wish I saw
it. I know, yeah. And I was like, yo, if this guy is drawing prophecy bear artwork, I need to know who he is. So I just kept doing the deep dive into your website and seeing all your artwork and your depictions of Phantasm and Hellraiser and Jason and all of our, you know, iconic horror villains. And then you were cool enough to do some artwork when I started Shock Till You Drop, you know? So it was great to see. And I think around that time too, you know, kind of take us back a little bit, but were you balancing the animation work, or at the time when you and I were talking, were you just doing pure illustration?
No, I'm still doing the whole animation thing. Right. I mean, not to go way far back, but, you know, I've been drawing monsters.
Oh, no. We want to go way far back.
Okay.
Let's go all the way.
So there was a small light. It was getting bigger. No, it's like I just been drawing monsters ever since I could hold a pencil. My parents would send me to, you know, private art teachers, and they would always say, he's either going to be a serial killer or he's going to make money in Hollywood. It's going to be one of the two.
And were you out here, or were you growing up in Burbank or something like that?
No, I'm from Ohio.
Okay.
So I was in Columbus. Total Midwest kid growing up. You know, Halloween really meant something there, you know. So totally was immersed in that world, but you know, and I went to art school and college. I never wanted to get into animation. I was like, I don't want to be a clone. I want to draw a mouse over and over again. And one of my friends is like, oh, I can hook you up with this job in animation. I'm like, I don't know. It's like, well, just talk to them. They call me up. I'm like, oh, wait, you'll pay me how much? And then, you know, literally they gave me 48 hours. I packed up all my crap in Ohio, said goodbye to my family and friends as though I was never going to see them again, and just head out here with $100. And luckily, got this job. But animation's been so good to me, and I was talking crap about it here at the beginning, but it's been really good, and it's been really fun ride. And I've been doing, you know, mainly action shows like Starship Troopers and Godzilla and Men in Black and Transformers now. You know, so, but always I'm drawing monsters on the side, you know, and even the whole Rob Zombie thing, you know, if you want me to tell the story, one day I just get this email and it says, hey, you know, I really love your art. Would you like to collaborate with something, Rob Z? And I thought it was one of my friends, you know, screwing with me. So I'm just like, hey, here's my phone number. If this is really Rob, you know, give me a call. Within like 10 seconds, it's like, hey, is this Rob? He's like, yeah. Oh, man. And we just talked for hours. And I really love working with Rob. I mean, getting to do these animated music videos for American Witch and Lords of Salem and stuff like that. And I was a fan of his music, you know, back in Ohio and stuff. So, you know, now seeing your artwork playing behind the band while they're playing, you know, and I went to one of the concerts, you know, and I'm my 40s now. I've got all this gray hair sitting there, and there's these 20-year-old, you know, millennial punks in front of me having fun. And one guy comes up with a T-shirt, and he kind of pushes me out of the way to tell his buddy, like, hey, look, this is my favorite artist on there. And I just,
oh, wow.
You know, and it was just, I didn't say anything, but it was just so cool to be like, yeah. That kid pushed me out of the way. He doesn't
for
care
you.
About me at all.
Out of the way for you.
Exactly.
It's almost a Back to the Future
movie. Yeah, it was like the biggest compliment.
Yeah.
He just, like, shoved me out of the way to talk about
incredible.
My art.
Well, you could find American Witch and the Lords of Salem music videos on YouTube.
Yeah,
and,
yeah,
yeah.
They're still readily available.
Favorite zombie film?
My favorite?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I don't. Gosh, that's tough because there's
one.
Oh, shit. Because right now it's between Fulci and Return of the Living Dead. I'm probably going to say Return of the Living Dead.
No, Rob Zombie movie.
Yeah, favorite.
Rob Zombie.
Oh, yeah.
Oh. You got to clarify, man.
Well, you said zombie.
Zombie is broad.
I forgot.
I felt we were on the topic. I took a risk.
I'm House of a Thousand Corpses.
Oh,
really?
Cool, yeah.
Really?
Okay.
That's interesting. For most, it's Devil's Rejects, but
I go Lords of Salem. We like Lords, both of us.
Yeah, and I rewatched both House and Lords, and the stuff that I like about it, it makes sense looking at your art. House is like...
It's
the way it was shot is gorgeous, and the way it was like kind of put together. Yeah,
yeah, it's got this Suspiria or Mario Bava like lighting throughout it, and I just love it. And you know, freaky, the Dr. Satan or whatever, just these freaky characters and stuff. Yeah. I really got into that. But Devil's Rejects did a lot for me because I did a comic with Rob for that, and it won like the Spectrum Illustration Award,
which
was great. Yeah. Which is hilarious, you know. It's like in this fine art book, and it's Devil's Rejects. You know?
I have that book. I have the whole Spectrum series.
Oh, do you?
Like 10 years.
I love it. It was number 13, I think.
That's awesome.
Wait, but we jumped the show. We jumped the gun because we didn't get the question. Because why are you drawing these monsters?
Yeah,
because
what were the movies that stood out to you as a kid? Because I know for me, like as soon as I saw, as a very young impressionable kid, as soon as I saw the Universal monsters. They didn't scare me. I wanted to try to draw them. I was like, oh, that's so cool. So what made you pick up the pencil?
I had parents. I love them so much. They're the greatest people, you know, I know. They were collectors, like collectibles. You know, my dad would be in baseball cards and he'd start a business. And you know, he was really into sci-fi. And I think it kind of pushed me into horror to find my own thing, but where I'd still relating to my dad. But they would take me to movies at least twice a week, like – you know, started with the drive-ins, and then I worked for my dad up into my 20s where we just, at lunch every day, go see a movie. And it was awesome. And most of it's genre stuff, you know. My greatest memory is a RoboCop with my dad or Aliens with my dad. You know, one day I was playing putt-putt, and my dad came up, and he's like, hey, hop in the car. We're going to go see Fright Night. And, you know, that was like one of my greatest moments, you know, in childhood. But
it's amazing.
But they would take me all the time. And I there's two movies that really messed me up when I was little. I was way too young. And they both happened around when I was probably like 7 or 8.
Uh-huh.
One was The Shining.
Yeah.
Don't take your kids to The Shining. Yeah. You know, my parents are like, cover your eyes when the naked woman's in the bathroom.
Yeah.
But of course I'm peeking, and then she turns into the old hag, you know. So that kind of messed me up for a while. And then Jaws, like, scared the hell out of me. I was in taking swimming lessons at the time and never learned to swim because of that movie. Because, I mean, I'm in Ohio. It's a landlocked state, you know. But I was going to swimming lessons and the teacher would always, like, put their arm up like a fin and say, hey, I'm a shark. Now get away. And I just got out of the water and walked home. It's like, I can't out swim a shark. What the hell are all you people doing? Like, just get out of the water. Roy Scheider said, get out of the water.
and then everywhere you were finding The Shining in real life. Like, yeah. Dad, don't hold
everywhere.
The axe like that.
I know. My dad's constantly, hey, you want some ice cream, Doc?
Like, no ice cream.
But I have all these comic books I was doing. Like, I still have them. And you know, I have a 13-year-old daughter now who goes through them, looks at them, and just laughs. Like, I had one called The Exorcist 306. And it was like – and I drew it in red and blue crayon to make – where it's just a character who just constantly throws up, but it's all in 3D, you know, doing the crayon. And I was just – I'm so proud of that. I keep it in, you know, like a cardboard and wrapping.
Yeah. You know? Can you post that one on our wall for Exorcist 306?
Yeah. I really want to see
that. That would be cool.
I will find it and scan it. It's like Exorcist 306 with this guy puking.
I love that.
You would share that for sure.
But you had – obviously you had supportive parents then, you know.
Absolutely.
Who were nurturing you the entire way.
You know what? Absolutely. And I – I got to say, I'm really fortunate because I never had anyone come out against my art in the subject matter. It's like even in high school, I remember I did a painting. We had to do a self-portrait and I was like, I'm going to blow everyone away. I'm doing a 6-foot tall portrait. But I only got to my waist. And I was like, you know what? I'm just going to make the rest entrails. And they hung it up next to the lunchroom in the high school. And it was there for like 2 years. And people told me like, yeah, you graduated, dude, but they still got your cut off body. I'm sick of seeing it. I'm sure it's not there now at this day and age. But, you know,
today it's like zero tolerance policy.
That was mid 80s.
No,
and we could get away with
it.
No
in high school.
Yeah.
No. So when did you make the leap from Ohio to California to pursue a career?
It was right after college. Yeah. I was pretty fortunate. I got a friend of mine that I grew up with came out here and got a job at Sony Pictures doing Extreme Ghostbusters, this cartoon.
Oh, yeah.
He brought me
on. I remember that one.
Yeah. So I came in as a, what they call cleanup artist or revisionist, where you take the storyboards that are done really loose and I just tighten them up and clean them up and put them on model, they say. By the end of that season, they moved me up the storyboards and jumped me. I went on to Godzilla. And before Godzilla was over, they moved me up to director. I was really fortunate.
And this was Godzilla, the Emmerich days?
Yeah,
the
but animation? It was the animated.
Yeah.
And then after that, it went on to Starship Troopers and all these other shows I mentioned. You know, and, now I'm producing on Transformers, which is really a lot of fun.
And for you, I mean, how did the animation skills and working in the studio system, so to speak, help refine your voice and who you were and what you wanted to do ultimately?
Well, I mean, it made me a stronger director in that, you know, it's very visual, I think, where I come from. I start with a blank piece of paper, you know, and, you know, you're constantly referring to the five C's of cinematography and all these books and, you know, in comics and everything else, just to, everything's about the composition, you know, in animation. You know, a lot of the shows I mentioned, I feel like, you know, I want to say we had some depth in there with the characters. We still have to give them acting, but it's primarily a visual medium, you know. So, you know, I think that that helps me a lot. And I brought a lot of that into Phantasm as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, because I storyboard absolutely every single shot and, you know.
What about the one element you can't control? Did it take you a while to, like, get along to working with actors? Because you can draw them, and then you're in control.
As
soon as, like Hitchcock at some point.
It is a different world, totally. I mean, I've been making short films, like horror films. I literally have thousands. I've been making them since I was, like, 13 years old. And I think that's why Don gravitated towards me in the first place, because I just – we became friends. I helped him on Bubba Hotep just doing some effects work. Which I had no idea how to do effects work. Don's just like, hey, can you do wire removal? I'm like, hell yeah, I can do wire removal. Go home, Google, wire removal.
What?
After effects.
didn't Don at the screening say you did the effect with the words coming out of the...
Dog Dick of Anubis.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Great movie.
So how did you first meet Don?
Yeah. Well, really quick, I want to ask...
Yeah, sorry, and I jump around, I'm so scatterbrained.
Before we move on from the animation, I just want to ask, what was the most gratifying experience? Was it Ghostbusters, Godzilla, or Starship Troopers?
As a fan.
Troopers for me.
I can imagine. I mean,
I'm a huge Godzilla fan, but I'm an old school Godzilla fan.
I just discovered that you're the bastard that made Tigger and Pooh 100 Acre Wood haunt. I have seen that shit so many times.
I knew that. You know what? I got to tell you, Winnie the Pooh, like, people have made fun of me for that. At the same time as when I was at the height of doing my Rob Zombie work.
Really?
I was doing Winnie the Pooh, and it really keeps you grounded, but I got some really...
Please tell me there's a fan film of Winnie the Pooh singing Rob
Zombie.
There's the Great Apocalypse Pooh. Where they recut Apocalypse Now.
I definitely have some artwork I'm probably not allowed to show.
Oh, wow. My daughter has no interest in anything I do, but as soon as I tell her that, she's going to be like, you met the Winnie the Pooh.
That's great. Cool. Hey, you know, it's out of my comfort zone, but I had a 2-year-old daughter at the time, and I wanted to be her hero, and, you know, that she can go to a record with me with the actors and have Jim Cummins, who did the voice of Pooh and Tigger, play with her action figures with her and doing the voices is awesome.
Gosh.
Of course, I asked her, like, hey, doesn't he sound just like Pooh and Tigger? She's like, eh, he's okay.
Awesome. All right, so sorry, Phantasm.
Not even Phantasm, just meeting John.
Well, seeing Phantasm.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Like the first time. Yeah, like, of course. Because I didn't see it till first year.
So I got to tell the story. I said it at a Fantastic Fest. I mean, I still remember this day, and I was even my parents went to the Egyptian premiere with me, and I was talking to my mom about it. When I was 7 years old in Westerville, Ohio, I went to this Little Professor bookstore. It was this just small bookstore in a mall. My mom took me in, and there was Fangoria issue number 2, and it had Frankenheimer's Prophecy Bear on the cover.
Right.
And
I
saw that bear. That's, you know.
And you were like, that bear is awesome.
It's still one of my favorite creatures, yeah. if totally want to remake that movie someday.
Does he know the trivia from our show? Who was in the bear costume all the time?
No.
Yeah.
Was that a
director of one of the Friday 13th films was bear. Yeah. Can you guess which Friday?
Oh, jeez.
Oh, there were two actors, yes.
I know.
There were two. He was one of them.
But it wasn't, Kevin Peter Hall or whatever?
I think he was the other guy.
Yeah, he might have been, yeah.
And the other guy was actually Tom McLaughlin, who directed.
Oh, really?
Jason Lives.
Oh, I didn't know it. Oh, that's freaking great.
Old episode of our show.
I like Jason Lives.
Yeah, we all.
I think he tells a story about how he tried to give a line reading from the bear costume or something to another actor. And Frankenheimer chewed his ass out.
Frankenheimer pulled him aside and said, don't do that. Ever.
Such a great image.
Well, that sleeping bag.
Yeah, yeah. Right,
I could just watch that.
Such a weird movie.
So yeah. So what was the question?
Fangoria.
Yes.
Phantasm.
Yeah, seeing Phantasm first time.
No, inside there was three images, but the two that stood out to me was the tall man's severed finger in the box with the yellow blood. And Michael Baldwin floating in front of this red background. And, I mean, I've never seen anything like it. I mean, of course, I'm, again, like 7 or 8 years old, begging my mom for this magazine to please, please get me this magazine. I don't know why it's clicking with me, but I love these monsters. I draw monsters. My mom was cool. She got it for me. And, you know, I would show friends, and it's like a dirty magazine. Like, come here, check this out. You ever see a severed finger? You know, it's I was, like, showing all this stuff. And friends' parents, like, why are you – why'd your mom give you that and all this stuff? But anyhow, that affected me, at a really young age. And then, back in Ohio, every video store had the guy that rents to underage kids, I was fortunate that my parents would send me on the bicycle to go pick up the movie. So they had to fill out this form that the underage kid can pick up the movie for him. So I would just be able to go see pretty much everything,
That form had a lot of power back in the day. Once your mom signed the consent,
you can pick up forms.
Yeah, when you had the membership.
Membership form, and it would have on the back of the card that it had my name. And it was like, this kid can pick this stuff up.
We just had stone teenagers that didn't give a fuck. Jesus.
Well, we broke into our video school. It was a whole heist.
But it made me feel really professional, check the back of the card, buddy. It's like,
I'm taking Hellraiser with me.
Yeah, yeah. My dad does want gore girls and Faces of Death, too. I'm sorry.
How old was this rental, though? Like, so you're 7 when you saw the picture. But
I had to be around 12 or 13.
Oh, so there was a long period before you got to see the film.
Absolutely.
Healthy.
But it really was, relating at that age, because that's the age of Michael Baldwin, during that movie.
We talk about entry horror sometimes in, like, The Gate and movies that are, like, perfect. I think Phantasm, even though it has a couple of the nudity stuff, it feels like almost the perfect, like, it would just mess your brain up.
Yeah.
That was, like, the first horror. If you're 10 years old, I can't even imagine what you would
especially
think.
For an adolescent boy, and if you had brothers and stuff, you kind of all done that sneaking around, checking him out, what's he doing with the girl, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
it's magic, though. But do you remember the feeling after you watched it the first time, though?
Oh, absolutely. I do and I don't. Like, it was so bizarre of a movie. It was one of those ones where I watched and I knew I liked it. I just didn't know how to wrap my brain around it. You know, I was a kid and I was very, at that age, I just wanted to see the gore and, Texas Chainsaw 2 was blowing me away and stuff like that at that age. So this was a totally different type of movie. It was
abstract.
It's abstract and where I care about the characters.
Yeah.
Like some of these other ones I'm mentioning, like Return of the Living Dead and Texas Chainsaw, there's still a camp factor and there's still a cartoon to the characters as much as I love them. But this movie I could really relate to.
What was your, as you got older and as the series went on, had you been, as
voracious? Did you have as voracious an appetite to dig into each entry as it came on? Or,
I did. You know, I was telling Don this the other day. It's like those movies aged and are really a sign of their era. Part two had a lot more action and a little cleaner budget. And that's what I was after at the time part two was out, you know. Yeah. And then part three came out and it had a little more of the 90s comedy and stuff in it. But, you know, there was still this fun factor. And then, you know, part four came out and started getting the more little existentialism and stuff like that. And, you know, and I'm starting to get older and, thinking when I watch movies now, you know. And, you know, so I really feel like I grew up with those movies. I was a huge fan, but were they like the one I always went to and shared with people? Probably not, you know. I didn't feel like I was in.
Well, it's not a consistent franchise, of course.
It's one of those ones where you almost hold for yourself. You don't want to share with other people. You know, it's like, this is mine. This is my movie. And, it's not a party movie. It's not
Well, because you have to know the characters. It's a character-based franchise.
And part of the appeal was they weren't always all easily accessible. I know that's really more of a rights thing, but it's like, you know, I didn't think they had like, I bought a UK box set just to get all of them together. Because I remember I was like, oh, I could find one is on Anchor Bay, but I won.
Is that the Sphere?
The Sphere, yeah, the Sphere still. And that was the only way I can get all four of them together. So it was kind of like, and I do love that it spans, like you just pointed out how it spans different time periods. I didn't even like realize that until now.
Well, I was talking about VHS, Rom.
Well, that's it.
But when it was it said $90 on the box, you know, retail $99 to rent.
Yeah, to rent it.
Did you find yourself identifying with different characters the older you got? Like if you start with the kid and then you move along?
Not really. Yeah, I always identified with Mike. I mean, because he was the same age, except for the James LeGros era. But, you know, as we went, I mean, we were all kind of the same age. So,
yeah.
Or at least I related to his age.
And for you, I mean, like, you know, Phantasm is certainly an interpretive film. But to you, what is the overall theme for you that stood out?
Well, when making, and I'll put this directly towards part five, because it ties into that.
It does tie
directly
into it,
You know, the first film for me, it's about that innocence of a little kid. You know, we all have this innocence and fear of death, you know. And Don talks about this when he was like 7 or 8 years old. He became aware of death, that we're all going to die someday. And he would think about that, you know, and that inspired him to make this movie. And I think most of the viewers were inspired by that too, you know, and how this went, you know, these kids' parents died, you know, and then by the end, is his brother dead? Is Reggie dead? You know, and with Phantasm 5, I wanted to bring some of that innocence back because, you know, by 2, 3, and 4, these characters have seen a lot of shit. And, you know, some of that innocence is gone. These guys are warriors now. And, you know, the best way was like Alzheimer's. Don and I were talking like Alzheimer's and dementia because, you know, we all had family members dealing with that at the time. And I remember, you know, some family members talking some crazy stuff and even thinking then, you know, it's like, wow, what if that's what they're seeing? Mm. You know, what if they're in some other reality? You know, their body's here, but their conscious mind is somewhere else. And, you know, Don and I would get really deep about this. And then, you know, and then we'd throw in giant spheres and cars with Gatling guns and all the macho fun shit guys do.
The but, CUDA.
Yeah, hell yeah.
I know we're jumping around a bit, but I mean, you just hit on that with the – I think that's what really hit me about the new movie. I really liked it a lot, but I think it was –
thank you.
Because you know what, it reminded me of Bubba Hotep in the sense that, like, Reggie's great in it, but now we're like at the end of both his life and the tall man's life, and in the same with the, you know, Angus obviously is no longer with us, but like getting, like, I was surprised by how emotionally invested I was because I've already known these characters for 4 movies, mm-hmm. and then I'm seeing them here in what I know will inevitably be the last movie, but that's kind of the theme, you know, and kind of that angle.
And we didn't want to shy away from the age, you know. Don and I were talking, oh, do you darken their hair up a little and try to play it off? It's like, no, it's been 18 years. You're not fooling anyone. Yeah. We're all older.
Yeah.
Let's, you know, take it and run with it. And,
18 years since 4?
Yeah.
Wow. How crazy is that?
That is crazy to think that movies can just last that span of time.
Well, Bubba Hotep, Don and I were talking, it's more than 10 years old.
Yeah.
Wow. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, that is crazy. It does. I'm saying I tweeted straight away when all this Phantasm started coming back. It's like, let's hope this also leads to a new Coscarelli movie himself. Because as a voice, he is such a youthful voice.
Oh, absolutely.
There aren't many people like that. Like, you know, and people think of him as a Masters of Horror, but he's so much younger than they are still.
Absolutely.
How old was he when the first Phantasm he made the shot?
He made that like when he was 22.
Yeah.
But he made
years old.
But he made two movies
right.
before
Kenny
that.
Yeah.
His first movie was he was at 18.
18.
Wow. I mean, it's the world's greatest, and then Kenny.
And this isn't digital. This is like actual film production. Yeah. Where it was, you know, real production.
Imagine
you know?
Being an 18-year-old navigating studio space.
Yeah.
Because that's what he was doing.
Well, imagine being a 40-year-old and working with that guy doing your first film. It's like, damn it,
you're legend.
Damn it.
It's been 18 years since the last film. What was it like going back to these actors and being like, okay, you want to do this one more time?
Well, I mean, maybe I should go back even further
and talk about
how this thing started.
There's a Masters of Horror connection, isn't there? Is that what it is?
Well, maybe I should go back even further because you guys asked how I met Don and how I get started because it all does kind of tie together. I mean, I was working at Sony at the time, and there was this comic at the time, Lenore, the little dead girl, you know, with Roman Dirge. And so Roman came to Sony, and I worked with him, and we directed this web series for Sony that's like nobody's ever seen. It's like I'm so proud of this thing. We did like 50 or something little 2-minute shorts. I got to find those because Sony's kind of TV animation went defunct, and I don't know what happened to all this material. But I was working on that at the time, and then a mutual friend of Don's, it was like his editor on Bubba Hotep. Don's already shot it. This editor called my editor on Starship Troopers and Lenore, and he needed some After Effects help. And this editor of mine, he was a buddy. We were just starting to try to get into like some sort of production for ourselves, whether doing main titles or something where, you know, I'm creative guy, he's business guy. And, you know, we were just trying to get this off the ground. And it was like, hey, here's this opportunity, Don Coscarelli. And we were just helping him with some minor little After Effects thing, and it was for the hieroglyphs for the dog dick of Anubis, but it wasn't a graphic. He just wanted a placeholder, at the time to put on there. And we're like, yeah, we can do it. And then I, you know, Don came in and met with me, and I showed him a bunch of my art and pitched him a main title for Bubba Hotep, you know. And I had this crazy thing I wanted to do, you know, with hieroglyphs, but they were like music notes too, you know. So it was like scenes of Elvis's life, but in hieroglyphs. And but it just got too unwieldy for what we wanted to do. And you know, I wanted to do it practical, like let's carve it out of stone. You know, it's like, and Don's like, it's not. This isn't how movies are made. From there, you know, Don's like, hey, why don't you do some artwork for the Book of Souls, you know, that Bruce Campbell's going to be looking through. So I did some of that, and we became good friends. And like I said earlier, he's like, hey, can you do wire removal? Hell yeah, we can do wire removal. So me and my buddy, his name is Michael Smith, we worked on it together, and Don gave us visual effects supervisors. We did pretty much all the visual effects stuff on that. Don had the Showtime Masters of Horror thing, and Don brought me in. I storyboarded a bunch of stuff. First day on the set, Don's like, hey, I need you to storyboard the rape scene. It's like my first day really on this set, just meeting people. I'm like, oh my God, it's so uncomfortable to draw. And I'm like, coverage man, you know, like I got like 30 different angles that I'm trying to pitch to Don, like, oh, you could shoot here, you could shoot here, you know, get the buttocks right here, you know. And from there, Don actually let me shoot some second unit stuff while we were there, you know, just some, you know, there's this guy Moonface, and he jumps over this railing, it's a slow-mo shot with his billowing cape. So I got to, you know, kind of do these shots and never got credit for it because of the Canadian unions. I think they gave me production consultant, which was actually at the time was a cooler, cooler title. Anyhow, and then from there, you know, I would send Don these little short films I'd make just every weekend. Here's another, and Don was like, he was loving these things, and I kept on telling him like, hey, why don't you come out with me sometime? Like, let's just have fun. There's no execs. You don't have to show anybody this thing if you hate it when you're done, but it's just fun to go out and experiment and come up with new camera angles, come up with, you know, just staying on top of your game, I guess. Yeah. For me, it's just fun. I just love to visually create things. And Don's like, hell yeah, let's do it. You know, this is going to be great. And he's like, hey, why don't I get Reggie and we'll do like a Phantasm thing. It's like, oh yeah, we could put on the DVD as an extra. What if that's an Easter egg? And I'm like, oh, this is going to be so cool. And in my mind, I'm just going along for the ride. Don's going to direct this thing. I'm just, you know, instigating it because I just want to see more Phantasm, right? And maybe I'll get to be a grip or something cool. But Don wanted me to film this stuff. So we did our very first shoot, which became the scene in the cabin with the girl Dawn,
right.
Where Reggie's playing the song and forgets her. So, you know, I just kind of tried to, you know, I wrote this little scene up and it's very derivative of what we'd expect from Reggie, but playing now that he's a little bit older and he falls asleep, he's actually got the chance to get laid, but he sleeps through it, you know? And then all the way up to the drilling of the ball. And that was actually Reggie and Gigi's house in their bedroom, you know, so we sprayed their bedroom with blood. But that became our very first time. So every, you know, we would do that. It's like, hey, let's go out another weekend. You know, it's like, hey, let's go out another weekend. And, you know, after we'd done like four or five of these, we took time off. Don went to work on John Dies. I went to go do the show Transformers Prime. And, you know, that was a good 2 years. And then we came back and, you know, I was like, Don, what are we going to do with this stuff? You know, we were going to do a web series. You know, we should do something with it. And Don's like, hey, I've been thinking about it, you know, and we're going to make part five, but you're directing.
Isn't it surreal? It
was totally surreal, but I didn't get time to enjoy it, honestly. Just talking about it right now is geeking me out because I'm like, holy shit, I'm talking about myself?
And if you didn't follow up, you know, I mean, that footage could have been sitting there, you know,
absolutely. We would have done something with it.
Well, how much was there at that point? Like, did you have like five or six scenes worth? And then it's like, all right,
I'll tell you. I mean, most of it is on screen. And at the time, I'm kind of saying this to you guys, we made that so long ago, 1080p cameras just became available. We were actually going to shoot that scene on my 720p camera because it was readily available. But we're like, nah, you know, let's really push it and see, because Don was already inkling John Dies at the end. It's like, hey, let's test some cameras, you know, and see. And the Red wasn't available or any of that yet. So we had this 720p went to 1080p. So you can kind of tell that in the movie, unfortunately. But I think it works in the storytelling and the nonlinear kind of storytelling, where I tried to treat it like a gritty indie film, handheld. And then, you know, once he wakes up in this other world, now I'm using dollies and more steady kind of shots. So we tried to work that into the story, but I totally lost track again of what the question is. I just rambled forever. It's
a process that's fascinating, you know, because, I mean, like, you could see it on the screen. I think I described it when I first saw it at Fantastic Fest as like most Phantasm movies, especially like even 3 and 4, there's a certain scrappy ambition to it, you know, where it's like, we're going to maintain the kind of crazy narrative, dreamlike logic. We're going to, as long as thematically it's sound, then you've got a great Phantasm movie.
Well,
you know?
and when we first put this thing together, like I said, they're just kind of vignettes, you know, they're little scenes, and there wasn't an overall story. You know, originally it was just going to be about Reggie.
Right.
It wasn't until we said part five that we start bringing everybody in. And during that 2 year downtime that I'm saying, even though I'm calling it downtime, that was time Don and I were really honing in on the script and how we can use this footage. Right. But it wasn't contingent on that footage. It was more of, can we use it? You know, and that's when the Alzheimer's came in and, you know, my favorite scenes in the movie are just Mike and Reggie in the park.
Yeah.
I'm really the most proud of those.
What about Bad News About Your Horse? Come on. A great line.
I got a story about that too, man. I got stories about everything. How we did that was pretty amazing. But
so in the process of assembling that footage, shooting the new stuff, overall, what was the time period? Like, once you kind of picked back up, and Don was like, we're making fun of
Oh, well, then we're on full
then
speed.
Then you were on full speed.
Yeah, right. Then it went pretty quick.
How did you keep it so quiet? That's the other thing. It's like
small crews. Yeah. I mean, you know, we're not advertising. We're not looking for people. We're not using agencies and stuff like that.
But did you have to go out to get a budget for that and say we're making a new Phantasm film to raise a budget?
No.
No. Okay. So
I mean, I don't know if Don wants me to say it or not, but I mean, I think a lot of it came from him, from his pocket. I'm not privy to where all of it comes from. But the thing is, you know, it was quiet, but it's like I would film my short films. I don't want to downplay the movie, but it really was a bunch of friends going out and having a good time. You know, I'm getting to work with Michael Baldwin, this guy that I've been saying I've been looking up to and grew up with. And, you know, Reggie Bannister, this badass. And, you know, you bring these guys in and then they're all guys that want to help. You know, everybody's moving cameras and resetting up lights. You know, I'm looking at these guys as huge movie stars. Yeah. You know, these are A-listers in my world. But, you know, everyone's working behind the camera to help get this thing going. And they all took me in with open arms, which I'm really surprised with. Being the outsider, I thought, you know, I was like, oh, man, I'm setting myself up for some trouble here. Don's only directs his property. He's so tight with his properties.
Now, is he there on set all the
time? Oh, absolutely. Okay.
I just, as a resource?
I am a fan.
Right.
I knew fans were going to say the same thing. I wouldn't do anything without Don. Right. Don was always on set. We'd always bounce ideas off of each other. It's still his world, you know, but same with the actors. I bounce the lines off of them. I'm not one of those directors where you got to read every word I wrote exactly to a T. I want these guys have a very natural, like Reggie's a very natural rhythm and want a sincerity to this. So, you know, I just shoot a lot of coverage.
So I have to ask, meeting Angus for the first time, talk about that.
Oh, man. That was like the scariest moment of my life. See, Don and I wrote a few our beginning lines for him, which was essentially became this white room scene in the movie. We went to a cheesecake factory in Beverly Hills somewhere, and it was just Don, Angus, and I. And, you know, Angus, he's got this very stone-cold, stoic presence to him. He's, you know, not really showing a lot of emotion, you know. So I'm kind of like, you know, I don't know how this guy's going to read it. And, you know, and he reads it, does it in character out loud. You know, and he just looks at me and says, hey, this is what the tall man would say.
At the Cheesecake Factory.
At the Cheesecake Factory, you know, and I got shrimp falling out of my mouth. Like, the tall man. I mean, so that was, you know, scary. But from that moment on, he became a friend and the sweetest, nicest guy I know everyone says about everyone in Hollywood. But I mean, he generally was. He'd come over to my house and bring his dog and, you know, the tall man would sit on my couch.
What type of dog did the tall man have?
I'm not totally sure. I would say it's some sort of poodle, little white.
I was picturing him with this tiny little white curly dog.
Like he's insecure.
And he loved that thing. <That's all. laughs>
How hard was it for, like, physically? Was I don't know what shape he was in, but just age-wise, how
well, I mean, obviously, you can see in the movie, he's not doing his walking around and running after Michael. That we've seen before, you know, it was kind of designed that way. The first scene with Angus in the movie was the last scene we shot, which was him in the bed. Mm. And by that time, we knew he was sick. The earlier stuff, when we're doing the Red Planet and all this stuff, had no idea he was sick. And his mental faculties were all there. He's witty and sharp as can be. And just he would work, you know, for 14-hour days. You know, we're doing the full thing. But by that bed scene, we knew he was ill. So we kind of designed that scene for him, which, again, is another one of my favorite scenes in the movie, is doing that kind of jump back to Jebediah Morningside. But, you know, just so you guys know, I made sure Angus saw the movie. He needed to see. I had to have the tall man's approval.
He actually got to see it.
Tell the story. That was my favorite part of the Fantastic Fest.
That was fun. Yeah, so, biggest fan of the series, honestly, is Don Coscarelli. He loves this world he's created. And, you know, and we worked on this thing together. I would do the editing, but I would always run every edit by Don. We worked really tight on this thing together. But the other person for me was Angus. I had to have Angus's approval or I'd suffer the wrath of the tall man. So I set up a screening room thing. We knew he was ill. It was just me, Don, Angus, and Reggie Bannister and his wife, Gigi. And I picked up Angus at his house and was driving him. And Angus, you know, as we're driving, he looks at me. He's like, you know, David, who's going to drive me home tonight? And I'm like, well, Angus, if you love the movie, I'm driving you home. if you hate the movie, Don's driving you home. And, you know, we watched the movie. I'm seriously sweating, white knuckling the whole time watching his face. Not any emotion. I'm just scared to death, you know, getting depressed as I'm watching it. And he comes up to me at the end and he's like, David, you're driving me home. And that was the best. And, you know, on our, I don't know if I said this at a Fantastic Fest, but afterwards, really, the movie inspired him to talk about his own mortality. We had this long, hour-long drive to his house talking about life and death. And it, for me, it was just really moving that the movie inspired him to talk. You know, I'd known him the least out of everyone on set, and that he wanted to talk about this stuff with me. It's really hard to watch these scenes now, knowing that. It's make me teary-eyed now. Yeah. It's like, you know, it really hit me hard. And
must have been a super important part of his life, though. I mean, it's the thing that people will remember him for. But how did he feel, like, as passionate as you guys did about the series?
Oh, absolutely. And he's passionate about the fans, you know. Yeah. Like I was saying, he would go to conventions. He would remember people's names from previous conventions if he saw them again. He was sharp, and he absolutely loved the fans, you know. And Don and I were talking about this the other day. It's really depressing that he can't be here now, because we're getting, you know, a lot of good hype around the movie, a lot of good advertising and stuff. And Angus would eat this up. It would be fantastic. He'd be here right now instead of me. Well deserved. I mean, he's amazing.
But it's also a brilliant send-off, you know?
Yeah.
No one can live forever. That's the thing, right? That's the thing.
Absolutely.
He obviously lived a real full life. I remember when we hosted the panel and we're we're all sitting there hearing about the Beatles.
I know.
Amazing. And that he had won an Emmy? Was it an Emmy?
A Grammy.
A Grammy. And our brains are just like, wow, what a life.
I know. And that's just like an aspect of him nobody knows. But that's such an important thing to win a Grammy.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. What was this quote about the Beatles? These guys might not have much talent.
Yeah. He did say something.
For people that don't know, he used to write liner notes for bands, for albums. Yeah. And he wrote the one for the first U.S. Beatles album. And when he heard it, said something like, boy, these guys are going to need my help. Let me figure out how I can write this.
They'll need all the help they can get.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is pretty amazing. But
yeah. So Reggie was obviously on board really, really early.
Yeah.
Part of your little experimentation. But and Angus obviously came in. Talk about, you know, working with Mike and Joe. You know, I mean, like, you want to obviously feel – you obviously want them to feel comfortable in your hands. How did Don help with that process?
Well, I mean, it's kind of hard to answer that because we really just jumped in. I'm trying to remember, you know, like I didn't
hear. Here's Mike.
That's really what it was. Yeah. It's like Mike landed from the plane. He came over to was working at Hasbro on Transformers. He comes in. Hey, let's do a quick try these costumes on. Let's see what they look like. You know, it was that fast. And then the next day we're out filming. I mean, I will say for me coming from animation, a lot of the actors I would deal with would like a line reading. You know, and first time I met Michael, I give him a line reading. He's like, never give me a line reading, you know. I'm like, but that's how I'm used to doing it, you know. Yeah. So, you know, I snapped out of that pretty quick. but no, Michael.
You also called him Optimus Prime, and he didn't like that. Optimus.
But no, I love Michael. Michael's actually a really a good friend now. And it's again, it's pretty amazing to go back and it's almost like two different people. You know, I have the fanboy version of me, and then there's the director side of me, you know. And when I'm directing, I do try to separate the two and not get caught up in my own, I'm directing this guy. For me, it really is, you know, we got a goal. We're trying to tell a story. And, you know, I think we're all great collaborators. I mean, I can't think of anyone I was fighting with on set or anything, you know, bringing Jody and Bill, you know, Bill Thornberry back in was amazing. He is a freaking cool guy. Yeah. He is Jody to me. I mean, he's laid back. He's cool. He's playing the guitar all the time. Really
he sang
guy.
A song at the premiere.
And he sounds freaking awesome.
He sounded great. Yeah, he just got up there with the guitar and said for Angus and just played us a song.
Well, I don't know if it's the same way for you guys and you too. It's like it's coming home. Like when you see these characters come on, you know, you're just like, I'm safe. I'm with these characters. I know, like, you feel, you know, it's like watching Star Wars, you know, the Force Awakens. It's like, and there's Han. Oh, there's Princess Leia. You know, you feel warm and cuddly.
There's something about, like, I mean, all of them are great, but, like Reggie's so good, like, on screen. Angus, the second he's on screen for any movie, but in particular this one, it's like, they're so good. Well, that there is that level of comfort. They're like, oh, I know these characters and I know this world.
And everybody's playing multiple versions of the same character. Yeah. They're still an essence of themselves in each character.
Even in the first one, Reggie, you think he's died. He comes back and you realize everyone else has died except them, and he's being more like a father figure. It's you know, the watching the remastered was a real the one scene that really stands out, and everyone talks about it, but for a reason, which is, you know, when they sit there and they play the guitars together, what was interesting about watching it this time is I was going, oh, this is the scene in any other film that would be cut out of a movie.
And
in this movie, it's the scene that actually begins the beginning point of you caring. It's the most important scene
in
the movie,
crazy?
Which is so
Don talks
there.
About that all the time.
It's unbelievable. You know? Like you, by the end of the scene, you're like, I like these guys.
Yeah, and Don and I would talk about that in this, you know, in Ravager, you know, we're cutting a scene. It's like, no, we got to make it tighter. We got to make it tighter for the audience today. And I'm like, is someone really going to walk out, Don? Or, you know, really, it's like, remember
that
they're
going to know
remember
the characters they're in.
Remember
you know?
Your guitar scene? You know, so we would always go back and forth, you know, in the edit bay. And, you know, that's it. That's a tough thing too when you're editing these kind of characters and where you want all this breathing room and a slower pace really, but yeah, you still want to keep it moving. It's pretty difficult.
I don't know. I mean, however comfortable you are talking about this, but in terms of the post-production process, how much of a challenge was this? Because I know that you did a lot of the work. You're a visual effects guy. You figure things out yourself. And the weight of it was on your shoulders for a good chunk of it.
It really was. I mean, this whole movie was ambitious from the get-go, know. Just to backtrack a little, Rob, I'd say as far as filming and what we've done behind the camera, my most proud moment is the car chase scene, right, with the spheres.
Yeah.
I did the whole car chase in one day, 60 or 70 camera setups, one camera. It was just me, Reggie, and Don, and Reggie's wife, Gigi. It's just the four of us out there.
Wow.
We drove out to, like, Lancaster Desert, you know, the roads start with one, and we're like in 300 and some. We're like in meth land, and there's nothing out there, nowhere to piss, nowhere to eat. There's literally nothing.
Oh, it's like near Devil's Rejects where a shot that area.
Yeah,
it's pretty close.
Yeah, yeah, near that. Where the hotel was stuff is out there. You know, so we shot all that, and it was like 100 and some degrees, 35 mile per hour winds. I'm an idiot. I'm like, I don't need sunblock. I don't need a hat, you know, and I'm sandblasted with sand. And, you know, I'm really proud of how we'd pull this stuff off because it was all coming from Don and I going, oh, my God, imagine the CUDA and a sphere and they're next to each other. And like the sphere is trying to hit the car off the road like Starsky and Hutch or something like that. Like, you know, like how cool would that be?
Imagine if Dan Schweiger tried to steal it.
He was awesome, though.
Yeah, that's a good sequence.
Let's put Dan Schweiger in his undies. Like, would he do it? Hell yeah, he'd do it. So to get back to your original question, I mean, there was a lot of ambition. So with the post work, you know, Don's always wanted to do a Red Planet, we always wanted to do spheres and stuff. And let me just say this, because there's a lot of CG in the movie, and, you know, some people hate that, some love it. It doesn't, you know, especially for a low budget thing, it's more of a necessity because of the tool. You know, we started out actually, for me, I want to do everything practical because it's less work for me in the long run, you know. Started this movie, I built a rig of a, you know, for the ball. I built this like green screen box around it, put it on a pole so I could basically like a jouster on my bicycle, you know, I'm riding around moving this thing around so I can get the reflections of the road and I can still be able to green screen the back of the sphere. But when I composite it, the spheres are so clean and so perfect. They actually look like a picture in picture, It looked really fake.
Yeah, ironic.
And then I just couldn't get the movement that we wanted. So we went with, you know, a couple guys that helped out with CG spheres, and they, you know, I was like, oh, this is actually looks pretty cool, and we do that. And this is kind of the nature why things took a long time. By the time we did that, I'm working on the next scene, and the next thing, a year's gone by, and then it's like new software's out, and I'm like, I got to make those spheres better, you know, because if a guy on YouTube can do it, I gotta be able to try to make them at least the best I possibly can with the knowledge I have. So things like the Red Planet, you know, Don and I actually went back to where he shot the original Red Planet, and just looking at rocks, but it's like, Don always wanted more than just a horizon line with a red sky and a split screen kind of effect. You know, and then it's like you naturally go to Vasquez Rocks and stuff like that. But, you know, there's plant life everywhere. It's like, you know, that'd be a pain in the butt to paint all that out. And then, you know, I'm just like, Don, we'll just shoot a green screen, and we'll kind of, you know, let's just go for it. And Don's like, yeah, let's just do it. And basically I just shot it. I went up to Nevada and took a bunch of back plates at the Valley of Fire, and then tried to build these 3D environments using those textures and stuff. I had no idea really how to do this stuff. I just like the puzzle and the figuring stuff out. I like jumping in. I feel like there's a creative solution to every problem. It might not always be the best solution, but you can come up with a creative way to solve it. And you know, one of those that I really like is the city scene. Like, we moved down the kind of destroyed city, you know, and that started out as just a map painting, you know. I was just going to zoom in on the map painting on Reggie in a window. And then, you know, I told Don, I was like, hey, give me a month. Let me try something, and started building a set and showed it to him. I was like, what do you think of this? Do you think we could do this? And it's not lit. It's just a gray, scene. He's like, yeah, that's cool. And then, you know, Don's like, hey, can you put us in it? So we did our cameos for it. But that shot took me like 2 months just for that one shot, basically because it's all on a laptop. Right. I don't have a render farm. And, you know, once you screw up after you've rendered for 48 hours or whatever, then you're like, damn it, I just had to change that one decimal point, you know, and you're starting all over again. So you know, we aimed really high, you know. Mm-hmm. I hope the fans appreciate that. You know, again, that's what I loved about, you know, the movies that I was growing up with. You know, a lot of them aimed high. They might not have practically been able to get there, but you know, it's still just got a cool look. I'm very proud of what we did with this.
I think you should be proud, because it feels like today, you know, a lot of the sequels that we see come along, or the sequels and the remakes, they feel like fan films. It's a lot of studios throwing a lot of money at basically, you know, high-budget fan films, you know. And this feels like 18 years later, you know, it's a DIY effort that feels like a perfect blend, you know. It moves really seamlessly into the series without, you know, under your guidance and Don's as well, you know. It just doesn't – like, I went into it and I was kind of curmudgeonly, because I was like – okay, I'm really excited, but, you know, it's going to probably feel like all the best of everything we love, but, you know, without no voice. And it's like, no, there is a voice. There's Don's voice, there's your voice, and it feels like the franchise voice.
Well,
so,
and it's hard to advertise that, too. Yeah. You know, the trailer...
the trailer's great, though.
Yeah, I do. I love the trailer, but it doesn't show you what the movie's about, because anything put in there...
It's just a lot of weirdness. And
you
the
wouldn't...
ball with a laser.
You give things away with whatever you could put in there. You have to put the cool factor in. No, thanks, Ryan. I mean, that means a lot, because I truly am a fan of this series, you know, and it does have a nonlinear type of storytelling. And for me, you know, I went into this thing, you know... Part of me is like, oh, this is an opportunity. You know, you get to direct your first live action feature film. But I'm such a fan of this series. It wasn't, for me, a demo reel. It wasn't like, hey, I'm going to show off my cool camera moves, my snap zooms. It wasn't meant to be that. I want it to fit on the shelf with all the other movies. I want people to respect it for the story, and that it really does go in hand with the other four movies, and feel as much as Don's movie as it was mine, you know, and that was important to me, just as a series. I didn't want it to just be, oh, and then there's that one by that guy. I'm sure some will look at it that way, but, you know, that's par for course. But I am really proud of what we pulled off.
And how have you been reacting? Have you been obsessively online looking at reactions?
I am. My wife and Don's son Andy, they always talk, and they're always like, you know, keep Dave away from stuff because I get so obsessive. Yeah. You know, I'm an illustrator, you know, I'm an artist. I get very emotional about this stuff. And when you put so much, I mean, there really is a lot of passion in this. I mean, I spent years of my life giving up my weekends. I've passed up other opportunities because I really believe in this movie. I believe in Don's series. I'm very grateful that he even put trust in an outsider to work on this thing, you know? So you just put so much into it and so much sweat and blood.
Do you think it got Don jazzed? I mean, obviously he's making it by your side the whole time, but do you think it got him jazzed making films again? Did it feel like this was like making a DIY non-studio-based situation?
Absolutely. I mean, we really did have fun. I mean, Don has actually become my best friend. Like, we are constantly talking about this stuff, and, you know, and we would still get on the phone, you know, and talk hypothetically, what if, you know, and pitching ideas back and forth. But, you know, Don always says, this is how we made the first film. And I think there was a lot of fun to that and a lot of, again, heart and passion goes into it by everybody involved. You know, this is a low-budget affair. It's not where everyone's getting rich off it. It's just we were passionate about telling a story.
And I know you didn't want to necessarily say right now, but can we talk about the Beastmaster 3 thing that you guys did? Is this like still out there with the creatures that put you in their thing and then the bones come out? That was my first favorite creature, actually.
You know what? Now you're talking about – because
that's a crazy thing.
Isn't that the joke? Like HBO stands for, hey, Beastmaster's on?
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, that's what I like.
That is brilliant. Oh, my gosh.
That's going to be the hashtag forever.
Hey, Beastmaster's on. That is amazing.
I don't know where I heard that. Someone
that new
told
show, Westworld's great. It's on Hey, Beastmaster's on.
Oh, same network.
But seriously, growing up, that was like on HBO
that's
like
totally,
three or four times a day.
That's one of the movies I remember. No, a funny moment happened.
Can we make a shirt of that?
Yeah, that's good. There was a moment.
An official Shockwave shirt.
We were at the Egyptian Theater, and I went to get a drink at the halfway between the two films, and I got stuck behind a big garbage can, and two men are right in front of me, and I'm like, and you know, at that place, when it's packed, you're just screwed.
Yeah.
And so I just stood there for a second, looked over at whoever I was with, and then I looked over and realized the two people stuck behind were you and Don, and Don had just gone live on Facebook on his phone, and the only person between them is me, and I'm standing there going, oh fuck, and I'm going, Hartman's gonna be on my show in the next day. Here I am, the idiot stuck on the Facebook cam.
Totally.
And it was also kind of cool to see Don going, I'm going, like, to see him into technology going, I'm going live on Facebook.
Oh, no.
And I'm stuck. So if that video exists on his page,
it does.
I'm the goofball literally standing going, and then I introduced myself to you just so you would not be so weird. It was pretty funny.
Here's a larger question. Has JJ Abrams seen it?
I have no idea.
Just because it's like 2016, the year that J.J. Abrams has come out as a Phantasm fan.
I know. I'm constantly pestering Don. Can J.J. see this? Hey, can J.J. see this? I literally have no idea.
Start the hashtag, give David a Star Wars film. David a Star Wars film. And if I get that, I want to cut it.
Just want to do one After Effects blaster laser. Yeah, even that would be enough to make me happy.
Just one Wilhelm scream.
Yeah.
That'd count.
So now that the film is out, obviously, you know, there's been no, you know, secret about, you know, Donna's talked about it publicly. They're saying there's a box set coming out, which must feel good to have them all finally together.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to be doing the process of the PR campaign. Now, what's next? What are you going to do?
I'm not really sure. I mean, right now, currently, personally working on supplemental stuff for the DVD. I have some really great behind the scenes. Like I said, I shoot a lot of coverage. So there's a lot of great stuff still to be seen, I think. So I'm hoping to get some of our deleted scenes because there's a lot of stuff we cut out for the web series that worked as a web because you're trying to do three parts in a 5 to 10 minute thing. You want three acts, but so we end up cutting a lot of stuff out. So hopefully, you know, we'll get to see that. And that's what I'm doing now. You know, then I'm kind of not sure. I'm still kind of new to this whole game. I'm on cloud nine right now, but I do think I'm going to hit that depression of not constantly having something there going on for 24 hours a day. So I'm sure I'm going to be trying to jump into the next thing, whatever that is. So,
what was it in the live action that coming from animation? What was it about the live action feature that what element did you like the most? Was it just the collaboration with everyone, all the different teams?
You know, that's tough because, like a lot of directors say, you know, filming it sucks and editing it's kind of fun. You know, I enjoy hanging out with everybody, but I'm dreading it for the days before each shoot. You know, like, good Lord, it's going to be a, you know, a good 20-hour shoot here. And I got, you know, be up at 4 a.m. What the hell, you know? So I hate that aspect of it. But then the second I'm there, you know, it's so much fun. And then really putting it together, you know, being able to edit the stuff, even dropping intent music from movies you respect and love who had a certain tone or emotion that you relate to and using that as a basis to even edit to, you know, that stuff's just so fascinating and you see where it comes together. And once you see it working and as the story, and especially with something like Phantasm Ravager, because I do come from a very linear type of storytelling, you know, and this was out of my comfort zone, being able to kind of edit it this way, you know, and some of it came out of the nature, like I said, of you starting out with these shorts and how we work into it. But it was also a fascinating aspect of the first film that if you watch the first film, it really is a bunch of small vignettes, you know, coming together. And there's not always a transition leading into each vignette. And, you know, it's really fascinating, the editing process and, you know, getting in there and things you think you need to get from point A to point B to point C, and then you cut B out, and you know your audience is smart enough to get to A and C without dwelling on whether a character walks across a room that's 20 steps. You know, you can cheat some of that stuff. So for me, that's actually a rewarding part of putting the whole thing together.
As a when it was a web series, when it was originally envisioned as a web series, was it called Ravager?
Did you guys have a working title? We were calling it tentatively Reggie Tales, and that was really because Veggie Tales was out at the time, and I was kind of
That's kind of adorable.
Oh my god!
And then hashtag Reggie Tales.
I have all these like CG titles I was making where I wanted to call it like Reggie's Two-Fisted Tales. You know, like you know, Phantasm to me always had the serialized feel to it. It always ends on a cliffhanger. You always want to see more of the same characters. It's this 37-year-old franchise still. Having the same characters in it. It has that pulpy serial feel to it. So at the time, you know, I just wanted it to be, you know, Reggie's Two-Fisted Tales, and, you know, he runs into this character and runs into that, and just, you know, it'd just be so cool. But, you know, it turned into Ravager. And Don brought that title on board. And I, you know, Cat Lester has a song about the lady in lavender, and she mentions the Ravagers in it. And I believe that's where it came from. Don't quote me on that, Don. if it's wrong, I'm sorry.
That's great. Now we could find you online at sidshowmonkey.com.
You've got to check out his artwork. It's really fantastic. You've got,
How many art books?
There's this one, volume one, another one. Yeah. I did like this this other one I'm really proud of. You can get Barnes & Noble. It's probably in the clearance aisle now. it was a kid's flip book. You know those flip books where you cut them in thirds and you can flip them? So I did one called 10,000 Zombies. So it's literally a combination up to 10,000 zombies you can make, mix and match the parts. And then Alexander Cox, who I believe co-wrote The Descent, he did all the stories on the inside for me.
Oh,
so,
cool.
I was really proud of that book, too. You got to check that one out. I'm sure it's like $7.99 or something really cheap at Barnes & Noble.
That's awesome. Ravager's VOD right now is remastered as well?
Remastered as VOD,
Actually, all five movies are available now. That's right. 2, 3, 4. And five. So
have they announced when the? I know it's Wells Go USA is doing.
Wells Go USA,
Have they announced a date yet, or is it still in the air?
I think it's still in the air. I've tentatively seen online. You know, I'm the director. I'm the last guy in the loop. But I've tentatively seen December. You know, that would make sense. You know, before Christmas. Right,
but this weekend is your chance to see both of them on the big screen.
That's right.
Absolutely. I mean, for me, an independent film of this means, you know, that were even in theaters is mind-numbing to me. You know, it's been a long time since I've seen this kind of picture in a theater. I mean, there's the big backed pictures, but you know, these kind of, like you said, kind of do-it-yourself attitude. You know, I believe we're in like 40 cities or something like that, which is really cool.
It's amazing.
So it really is. So
Well, congratulations.
No, yeah, thank you.
And thank you for coming on the show as well.
So much for joining us.
I really appreciate it. I listened to the show, so I love it. So it's an honor to be here, guys.
That's so great. Thanks so much, man.
No, thank you, guys. Thank you.
Yeah, it's out now. Check it out, man. New Phantasm movie.
Eat some ice cream with Reggie.
Want some ice cream?
Yeah, thanks, everyone.